coming up in a moment. Sean David Morton. And he is back by popular acclaim. It was, what, a week ago when the whole thing with the president began. I started getting facts after facts after facts saying, oh, my God, Art, do you realize Sean David Morton predicted this as one of his major first of the year predictions? And I said, yes, indeed. And Sean sent me a fax saying, Art, I've got the flu. And, oh, he was down with the flu the way I was. So he didn't get with us last week, but we've got him here tonight. And you've got to have a lot of respect for somebody who gets a hit like this. I mean, that was out of the blue. Nobody could have predicted that the president would be facing possibly a politically fatal scandal this year, early this year. But Sean hit it on the head. Sean David Morton has degrees in drama, political science, organic chemistry from the University of Southern California. He attended Stanford, the British International School in Cairo, Egypt, and has a doctorate in theology as well. In the summer of 76, he was part of a team that developed the original remote viewing protocols at the Stanford Research Institute. Then later he studied Tibetan Buddhism with the Dalai Lama at his school in India. Later became an initiated monk of the Black Hat Black Hat Order at a monastery in Nepal. It was there that he mastered certain meditation techniques that allow him to journey into and visualize future events and tune into the frequency of our Earth. He has used this visionary technique with obvious great success in predicting very specific Earth changes and occurrences. So, coming up in just a very few moments, Sean David Morton, who called what's occurring right now. Sean, welcome to the program.
Oh, thank you so much, Art. It's and congratulations on the definitely the triple crown of you and Rush and Dr. Laura.
Yeah, and that's something. It's a very proud moment.
Well, it's I guess just to prove to them that there's not going to be a change in the programming. You're having a crazy guy like me back on the show, huh?
Oh, there'll be no change. You know, these people are smart, and they don't mess around with that which works. And that is their reputation, and this works, albeit in a strange kind of weird way. I understand my program is kind of weird, and I have it ironclad that that weirdness will be allowed to continue. So,
well, that's fantastic.
Anyway, there's nothing weird about what you did. Look, you... I'm telling you, I was swamped with faxes and email and everybody saying, don't you realize Sean Morton called this? He said
goodness.
This would happen.
Well, it's actually been a long time coming because the original predictions that I made regarding Clinton and his career, I actually made before he was even elected president. In the manuscript that I wrote, gosh, back in September of 1990, actually it goes as far back as the spring of 92, quite specifically, I got up on the radio at a time when George Bush's approval rating was close to 80%, and nobody thought that anybody was going to beat him in the fall. And I said, George Bush is not going to be the president of the United States.
That's right.
A Democrat is going to be elected president. When I saw Clinton originally, he had a, I guess you could call it sort of a dark glow around him, so to speak, that, and I remember pointing at the TV saying, oh my God, this guy's going to be president of the United States. And then when I actually published in, September of 1992, exactly what it was I was publishing was, specifically that Ross Perot, and this was, the 17th of September that I put this in the book, that Ross Perot would re-enter the presidential race. That happened within 2 weeks after that. That specifically Clinton would win the election, that he would win the election with 42% of the vote. That exactly happened. I called the exact percentage he would win by. And actually the number 42 is very strange connected with Clinton because 4 plus 2 is 6. And Clinton was the 42nd governor of Arkansas. He's the 42nd president of the United States. I think that his there will be something with his resignation or something with him being removed from office, I think, by this August, something about the 24th, the date comes up once again, 2 and 4 equaling 6.
So you see the bigger picture with what's going to occur with Clinton. Do you see, I mean, here we are tonight with Monica Lewinsky having not made a deal yet with the special prosecutor, and if you were to call it tonight, you'd say, well, he's not going to get forced from office because of this, probably. Even though, you know, it could obviously go the wrong way very quickly, as of tonight, you would have to say, I doubt he'll be forced from office by Monica Lewinsky.
Well, it's going to be an accumulation. It's what I initially talked about on your program when we were last on December 28th, that it's going to be like watching a man fall off a cliff in a Charlie Chaplin movie. He's literally going to, on his way down, literally hit every bump and cliff and
on the way
that you can possibly strike before this before he hits bottom. And the thing is that when I was talking about his election all the way back in 1992, some interesting things that I saw. I saw, and just to give you the whole range of the prediction, to let you judge what's coming true and what isn't, I saw him as being the last elected president of the United States. Whether or not that's going to happen, I don't know. It depends on, you know, how, if the country falls apart by the year 2000 or not, or what's going to happen economically with some other things that hopefully we'll talk about later. I saw an accident directly after his inauguration that involved him getting out of a cart or a vehicle of some kind that damaged his knee and his shin, and that was, interestingly enough, after his second inauguration, not after the first one.
That's right.
But there's another thing as well, is that Clinton was inaugurated the second time under what astrologically is called, or should I say astronomically as well, is called a void of course moon. And how this works is that the moon, very much like the sun, moves through the ecliptic in the sky, through the zodiac or zoo of animals, as it's called. And the moon has a rather erratic orbit. And what happens is that when the moon is void of course, it means it's between two astrological signs. In this case, it was in a very specific degree directly between Gemini and Cancer. This was the worst place. And I would have thought that because Hillary is interested in a lot of this, and of course Clinton is interested in astrology, that he would have found some excuse to be late, even by 15 or 20 minutes or so, and he could have avoided this horrible aspect that came in. He was actually, that particular degree that he was inaugurated on the second time is almost the exact same degree that Nixon was inaugurated in 1973. And you're seeing a lot of very interesting parallels. I mean,
okay, that is numerology / astrology, isn't it?
Well, it's astrology based on the time that he took the oath of office.
All right. Well, I don't think he's paid attention to that kind of thing. Now, we all know the Reagan administration did. But I don't think Clinton has paid attention. Would you say that's obvious based on what you just said?
It would have been, because if anybody in his administration knew anything about how this worked, they would have realized that you don't sign contracts or take oaths or do anything of any importance under this period of time, a void of course moon, because everything that happens under that particular period is doomed to failure, especially, and we're going to get into some of the similarities of what's going on between him and the very spooky similarities of what happened to Nixon between 1973 and the 20 months he remained in office.
I'll never forget that.
After that.
Right.
Some of the interesting similarities are not only was it about the same degree, but also the same degree that JFK also took the oath of office when he was inaugurated in 1961. In the history of the Republic, there has never been, ever, a president that has taken the oath of office under a void of course moon and survived either physically or politically that term. Every single one, you can trace it back all the way to the beginning from when it first happened, I think, with Tyler back in the 1820s. There has never been a president under void of course moon that has managed to survive his term of office. Here's the other strange thing as well, is that under this particular degree of void of course moon, you're looking at not only legal attacks against him, but a good possibility of terrorist attacks as well.
May I stop you for a second?
Yes.
Because I want to ask you again about void of course moon. I would assume that doing anything under void of course moon for anybody, not just the president, but anybody, would be a poor idea.
Yes.
So we should all then understand what void of course moon is.
Okay. It's quite specifically, it means that the moon takes about 28, sometimes 29 days to actually go through to go through the zodiac. And it is a period of time when the moon is actually sort of wobbling in its orbit. And what happens is that it wobbles in such a way that it's literally in between two signs. It doesn't really have a degree. And in this case, it was actually directly in between the signs of Gemini
and Cancer.
And that's particularly auspicious because, astrologically speaking, the United States is actually a Cancer country, you know, July 4th and all, with Gemini rising, which is why we're a country that is so obsessed and also so dynamic with communication. It very much describes the rising sign of the United States being sort of the it's why we're so schizophrenic. It's why we sort of have a dual personality.
Okay, for the sake of the audience and me, how do we know at any given moment where the moon is?
No.
Is there a way the average person can check and understand when we're getting into this wobble period?
Yeah, any astrological calendar that's sold by Llewellyn's or Maynard, any ephemeris, you know, it's very easy. You just buy yourself an astrological calendar that will actually, or actually an astronomical calendar even, that will simply tell you when the void of course moon is.
May I bring one other little thing up to you?
Sure.
You know when I was born?
No.
June 17th, 1945.
Okay.
Do you know that June 17th is Gemini almost into Cancer?
Yes, it's right on the you're right on the cusp.
Is that the particular period of time we're talking about here?
Yeah, well, that's why you're the voice of America, Art.
Oh my! All right.
So that's the time we're talking about, as far as the moon is concerned, as far as that particular degree with the moon.
So don't sign contracts, don't enter into deals at that particular time,
or take an oath to become president of the United States at that particular time.
And, okay.
And I guess Clinton didn't have any choice because you have to take the oath of office at exactly 12 noon on that particular Monday. And you know, if I was him, I would have
put it off.
Found a reason to be late. 20 minutes, even 20 minutes or so, would have you know, would have saved him this disaster. But it's going to be an accumulation of everything. It's not going to be Monica Lewinsky and Linda Tripp and Paula Jones. I think he might even it's my belief that he'll probably beat the Paula Jones case. It's going to have more to do just the aspect of Clinton's chart astrologically is that everything that he touches that regards anything that has to do with foreigners or foreign powers or foreign countries,
mm-hmm.
Is disaster for him. Whether or not it's Bosnia or Iraq or Chinese money or, I mean, that's what he's going to be investigated for, and that's what he's eventually going to go down for. But as I said, there is also the possibility of not only legal crucifixion for misbehavior and misdeeds in office, but a violent attack as well. I'm not. Certainly, in no way, shape, or form, condoning it or want him harmed in any way. I'm just saying that he needs
that
to be very, very, very careful for the next few months, especially with the fact that we're about ready to go to war with the Iraqis in probably less than 10 days or so. Here's the interesting similarities between what's going on with Clinton and what happened with Nixon. The first thing, and this is the first thing that popped right out at me, is the exact degree that he took his oath of office for the second term was the exact degree that the moon was in when Nixon did it in 1973.
Right.
Isn't it interesting that Monica Lewinsky lived inside the Watergate complex?
Yes.
That's the first thing that jumps out at you.
It's true.
The next thing that jumps out at you is Clinton, along with Nixon, is being hoisted by his own petard because
yes.
of tapes that were made of obscene or illicit conversations, supposed phone sex conversations that that Clinton was making.
By the way, Sean,
yeah.
Do you suppose it's occurred to the special prosecutor yet that they no doubt still do taping in the White House, as they did when Richard Nixon was there? And I wonder if he's considering subpoenaing those tapes.
Well, Richard Nixon started it so that he could actually make sure that his place in history would be secured.
Well, it certainly is. Sean, hold on. We're at the bottom of the hour. This is... Well, you said it. President Nixon certainly assured his place in history with those tapes. Do you suppose they are still taping in the White House?
Well, they must be. I thought it was a national security directive that was actually begun by Nixon to continue taping in the White House. However, the it was very interesting because there was a book by Gary Aldrich that was that I think a lot of people should read called Unlimited Access. And Gary Aldrich has been on the news, actually was on quite some time today, and he was talking about the fact that that the reason there's sort of this cloud of smarminess around the Clinton administration is because it was the Secret Service's job to keep 21-year-old interns like Monica Lewinsky away from the President of the United States, especially this President of the United States, that they ran security checks on people who had felony backgrounds, people who were incessant habitual drug users. The interns were running so crazy in the White House that Aldrich himself was brought in to give these people, give these kids a lecture, saying that your behavior would reflect on the President of the United States and then the Office of the Presidency, only to then have the White House Chief of Staff come in and say to the kids, well, we don't want to be narcs or anything. We just don't want you kids to get caught. You can do whatever you want, just don't get caught. So it's, and of course I think a lot of the allegations that Aldrich made in his book Unlimited Access are going to start hitting the public eye. I mean, it's not over yet. Paula Jones and Monica are obviously, they're not the end of the string. I think that there's going to be as many as four women at the end of this that are going to be involved. Aldrich himself was saying in his book that Clinton was sneaking out of the White House, that he was going into as a matter of fact, he was talking about this today on the news, that he was going to a limousine, covering himself up with a blanket, and then having them drive him to the Marriott, where there was an underground parking lot where you could actually get out of the car, get in an elevator, and access the penthouse floors of the Marriott in Washington without being seen by the front desk. And he was having trysts with somebody Aldrich claimed was a Hollywood movie star, some Hollywood celebrity, so that the leader of the free world was literally out of touch with every responsibility that he needed to be in touch with, obviously the nuclear trigger, for hours at a time when the Secret Service had no idea really where he was. So I think that his and Hillary's both disdain for the simple protocols that are supposed to go along with the dignity of the office of president are going to have a lot to do with the public hue and outcry of a change in focus as far as the presidency. People are going to want to restore some kind of dignity to the presidency. Along with this, I'm not sure if you've seen the interviews with Dick Morris.
Oh, I have, yes.
Yeah, I mean, Dick Morris virtually came out today and said that, well, Hillary Clinton is a lesbian, is bisexual, and that's the excuse that he gave for Clinton acting the way he does, is that that Hillary was not that interested in men. And I thought, that was a shocking and outrageous allegation for Dick Morris to make, especially considering Dick Morris's background. Now, the interesting thing about the coincidences between what happened in Nixon.
Here, all right, let me tell you two things that people say.
Okay.
Maybe all you have just said is so, but people still seem to be saying, look, yeah, maybe Hillary has that interest. Maybe Bill is out having trysts. But frankly, as a nation, we don't give a damn.
Right.
It seems to be doing a good job as president. And to have him taken out now as a result of one of these Monica Lewinsky type scandals is something we don't want. 68% of the people say it is not a reason for him to leave his job. Now, is that simply selfishness on the part of the voters? In other words, they think things otherwise are going pretty well, and they credit him with that. And so, unless he really does something outrageous, leave him there.
Well, the gist of it is that, and this is kind of what shocked me about all this. I had a hard copy at my house all day today because apparently they heard your show in December.
Right.
And so the hard copy piece is going to be on Monday. The aspect of this is that why is this week any different than what was going on with him with Jennifer Flowers back in back before he became president?
Right.
I'm sure the public has known for a long time that he's a philanderer, certainly as bad or worse than Kennedy ever was. He's just more blatant about it, and you know, it doesn't have as much style, I don't think.
Yeah, you know what a lot of people say who fax me?
What's that? They say,
we want a president smart enough not to get caught.
Yes.
They're not saying they don't want him to do it. They're saying they don't want him to get caught.
Well, I guess, but once again, that deals with the whole morality of the country, isn't it? I mean,
yes.
It's not that Clinton is immoral. I mean, I could handle it if he was immoral. It's that he's amoral.
Amoral.
Is that he doesn't even know. And it's like asking people today, well, if you did a wrong thing and you didn't get caught, is it all right? And, you know, 70% of the people will probably say, well, as long as I didn't get caught, it's fine. You know, I mean, I think that has a lot to say with the rather sorry state of the country.
Well, look at Nixon. I mean, look at Nixon. Now, had he burned the tapes in the first place, we would never have been aware. He would have, to all the world, seemed a wonderful president who opened up China and did a lot of other good things and was a firm hand at the helm and all the rest of it.
Right.
Would have been regarded very differently by history.
Well, and remember too that it was not, and this came out in the Watergate trials and the Watergate hearings, that it wasn't Nixon that ordered the bugging in the first place. It was Kissinger. It was just Nixon that was responsible for the cover-up and trying to save his friends for doing what Henry Kissinger told him to do.
Yeah, it's interesting. I saw Henry Kissinger on TV the other day and commenting on this whole thing, and I couldn't believe it. I said, wow, look, Henry Kissinger. I didn't know he was still around.
And isn't it interesting that you had Colby and G. Gordon Liddy in jail saying that, you know, here we are rotting in jail while the guy that ordered the break-in is getting the Nobel Peace Prize. Isn't that rather ironic?
That's right.
So here's where it continues with the rather bizarre allegories with Clinton. And this freaked me out when I heard about it, is that so now we have Monica Lewinsky, who's coming out of the thing from out of the Watergate compound again. We have the tapes originally of Nixon, and now we've got tapes with Clinton in which he'll be hoisted upon. Now, here's the even stranger thing. Remember when his plane, they had a big national live news media thing when Air Force One broke?
Of course.
Okay.
I think it got stuck in the mud,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, but you know the significance of there were two other planes that he actually tried to get off on? This is what freaked me out.
Well, I think it was a 707, wasn't
it? But you know what 707 that was? That was the 707 that Richard Nixon took out of Washington the day that he resigned the presidency.
You're kidding.
I am not. And he had to then transfer a second time. That 707, if you can imagine this, that 707 got stuck or got laid up somewhere, and they had to transfer him to yet a third plane. And the third plane, the third 707 that they put him on, was the plane that took JFK's body from Dallas back to Washington, D.C.
Good Lord. And do you know that on top of that, I believe it was the third one that finally flew and then had a rather close encounter of the closer than 3 mile kind with some other commercial aircraft,
yes,
which is a big no-no.
And almost crashed.
Yeah.
So isn't that, I mean, it was just, I was in shock because I'm viewing this whole, rather indicative thing of all the things that are going down. Clinton is falling into a... It's almost like watching a Shakespearean play, that he's falling into this downward spiral that he is not going to be able to extricate himself from.
Well, I very much like your earlier analogy of falling off the cliff and hitting every single outcropping, every single rock and jagged piece on the way down.
And screaming all the way down, I didn't do it! I'm innocent! I did not have sex with that woman! And, of course, the joke is that he called Monica at halftime at the Super Bowl and said, no, Monica, I told you to lie in the position.
Oh, my God. Hey, let's talk about that a little bit. The first time in, so long, the AFC and the Denver Broncos take the Super Bowl. What a shock it was to me.
I guess we were both wrong, huh, Art?
Yeah.
Because you thought it was the Green Bay Packers, and here I thought, I thought the Niners were going to get in there. But actually, I bet on the AFC. And the reason I bet on the AFC and bet on the Broncos winning is that once again, here's another very interesting cycle and pattern. Used to be when there was the parity between the AFC and the NFC, and of course you remember in the 70s and the early 80s, you had the Steelers who were dominant, the Dolphins who were dominant, the Raiders won it a couple of times or so, but it was the AFC and it was very much back and forth. Now, the last time the AFC won was 1984. Wow. And that was actually just about when a lot of Reagan's programs started kicking in, when the interest rates started coming down, when the stock market began to steadily rise.
Right.
And actually for the last 13 years, we've had a very, very steady upward growth and expansion in the United States due to, for example, the invention of things like, you know, the home computer, the fax machine, you know, all of the electronic doodads that we have in our reality today all began to hit the marketplace about 1984, which began to grow and expand the U.S. economy.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that this year, for the first time that you're about to see, by October, you're going to see an implosion of the economy, a beginning of the slowdown of the economy, and the old tradition is, and this is, I didn't make this up, this has been sage wisdom for a long time, that when the NFC or an NFC team wins the Super Bowl, that you have an economic upswing and an economic and stock market upsurge. When an AFC team, like the Denver Broncos, wins the Super Bowl, you have an economic downsurge and a stock market collapse and a, I guess you would call it, downward spike in the economy for that year.
And somewhere in the mix of all of that, the length of women's skirts.
Oh yeah, that's another thing too. That if they're obviously the women's skirts, when the women's skirts go up, it's sort of the mini skirts. The more leg they're showing, then that means that the stock market is going to do well and the economy is going to expand. And when women's skirts go down, at least down to mid calf or so, that also means that, you know, it has something to do with the economy as well.
The stock market likes legs.
But it was just kind of an interesting myth. I actually bet on the Broncos. I think I bet on the Broncos when it was 5-1 against them winning. And the closer it got to the Super Bowl, I think it was 3-1 finally by the time the Super Bowl was played.
Oh, the line began to shift fiercely.
Yes.
I should have paid attention to it.
So that was that's just kind of a fun, fun, interesting cycle that, when the AFC wins the Super Bowl, that there's an economic downswing. And I think that's what you're going to see. Well, obviously, you're seeing what's happening with the Asian markets right now. The entire Asian flu, I think, is a gear up for what you're going to see start happening to the United States, not this year, but later this year and in the beginning of 1999.
The market just broached, just passed, I believe, 8,000
right
today.
It's going to continue. The market itself, you see, here's the weird thing about the way the market works. We talked about this on the last part of the show, is that it's my belief that that specifically what a small consortium of banks is trying to do is trying to collapse a number of the smaller banks to create sort of a larger super fund, if you will, a larger centralized bank. And that what they want to do is repeal the last planks of the Glass-Steagall Act, which would allow commercial banks to be involved in specifically speculative stocks and or securities, and also involved in insurance. Now, of course, the third plank of Glass-Steagall was disallowing savings and loans and various commercial banks from getting involved in or various banks from getting involved in commercial real estate. And of course, when they repealed that aspect of the Glass-Steagall Act back in the 1980s, what was it, $350 to $500 billion later, some enormous hemorrhage of money. I think only two guys ever went to jail. It was the largest bank robbery in U.S. history.
Mm-hmm.
You're having that exact same cycle and pattern is now being repeated in Japan, where the Japanese Yakuza, organized crime in Japan, has now stolen close to $1 trillion, which is what's now forced the United States, Britain, and France to devalue Asian stocks and bonds, which is what is plummeting the various Asian currencies. And, of course, we're bailing them out to the tune of billions of dollars. There's not enough money for health care, not enough money to prop up Social Security, but there's always enough money to prop up a bank in some third-world banana republic.
Well, I must have seen a million interviews with economists who were all questioned about the Asian crisis effect on the U.S. economy. And generally, they said there wouldn't be much. And so far, frankly, there has not been. Will it hit? And if so, when?
Well, here's the thing, from the get-go, since 1994, I've been saying that the Japanese economy would begin to collapse. The biggest problem is that Japan holds a large number of U.S. bonds, and that when they begin to cash, they hold basically something like a third of our debt. But the stock market is a very weird animal, and it's a strange animal in the fact that the worse the actual physical economy is doing, it seems as though the better the stock market does. It seems to be removed from the actual
it really does.
You know, the actual rank and file of what's happening to the American people. I still think, and I'll stand by this again, I believe that the stock market, and I was alone in my predictions for many years, that the stock market would hit 8,000. That when it hit 8,000, that you were going to have a serious profit taking, that you were going to start to see the Asian markets begin to collapse. And, you know, this was several years ago that I was talking about this, but it's all coming to fruition now.
Right.
I still think that if the government repeals the Glass-Steagall Act, and if you get, say, mom-and-pop mutual funds or a way to actually allow grandma and grandpa to invest their Social Security funds in the stock market, you're going to see the stock market skyrocket. You're going to see it go to 10,000, possibly well beyond.
Wow.
It will hit the ceiling at about 12,000 or so. Now this is predicate, though, and it's predicate upon the fact that does the government repeal Glass-Steagall? Do they allow commercial banks to get involved in stocks, bonds, and securities, putting us right back in the frying pan where we were in 1929? Because then if the stock market goes belly up, then all the banks go. But this is a way for them to get their hands on everything. This once again, small consortium of people led by the Chase Manhattan Bank flagship, led by David Rockefeller, our buddy up there, who wants to consolidate his power and believes that he'll be able to have a stranglehold on the economy of the United States and the world by the year 2002. And this is not, you know, I just listen to what these guys say. I mean, when they put out a report in the Council on Foreign Relations Quarterly that's written by David Rockefeller or Henry Kissinger, you know, they tell you what it is they're going to do. This has very little to do with psychic powers or psychic predictions.
All you've got to do is listen.
This just has to do with you listen to what these people say. They tell you what it is they're going to do to you beforehand, and it's just a question of then listening and then trying to use what I call scum logic, which is how does the scum on the top of the pond think, and how is it that they're going to try to grab everybody's money, and how is the 1% of scum at the top of the pond going to basically screw everybody else underneath them so that they can consolidate their wealth into a single superstructure of a consortium, an oligarchy, if you will, of economic interest.
I think everybody knows that is exactly how it works. David, I want to ask you this because I really am curious. When you make a prediction, particularly a very specific prediction like about the president, and then you wake up one day sort of stricken with the flu, you turn on the television and you see the prediction you made is coming true, what does it feel like?
Well, you sort of get giddy at first, and then you think, it's a little bit more interesting with the Clinton prediction. To give you another idea, when I predicted the Northridge quake,
right,
and I was in, you know, abject horror. I mean, I was climbing the walls. My body was reacting to what was going on. I was literally had a box of Cheerios and a .38, and I'm hiding under my desk, you know, I mean, just waiting for this thing to happen. That when something like the Northridge quake happens, it's one of those things where you think, oh, my God, isn't there something that I could have done? You know, is there some prayer, some meditation, some way that I could have warned people better?
So, in other words, you actually have a little bit of guilt associated with a hit like
that. Well, of course, because if I believed that any of these predictions could not be changed by intelligent human action, prayer, and meditation, I might as well just give up, blow my brains out, or go.
So, in other words, the Northridge quake then is a little bit your fault.
Well, no.
Hold on, David. We'll be right back to you. This is Coast to Coast AM. That documented, apparently, an entire family being abducted. And it was horrific. It went on for an hour. It was stunning, to say the very least. But was it real? That's the question. I had a million faxes about this. As a matter of fact, this is due to rerun. I've got the time someplace or another here. It's going to run again so you can see it. I had an opportunity to talk briefly with Sean about this incredible program, and let's find out what he thinks now. Sean, you saw that, I presume.
Well, yes, it was on, and, you know, of course, I called you, I think it was the next day.
That's right.
You know, because I feel that you're very much the man of the hour as far as this goes, and, you know, you're a voice that's a voice of reason in the field and a voice that's listened to, and, I was just shocked. I mean, I was completely outraged by the whole thing. I called the president of UPN and yelled at him, you know, that how dare he put this crap on the air when we're trying to get legitimate stuff on the program. And of course, I was one of the original team of creator producers for Strange Universe, for the pilot for Strange Universe.
Yes.
I've been a consultant for Unsolved Mysteries. I produced a segment for the opening show of Sightings. I was involved with the Sci-Fi Channel. I mean, you know, that's what I do, is I write and produce for television and film. About 3 years ago, we got a hold of a videotape that was called The Alien Birthday Party. And on this videotape, it was 1 hour. The whole thing was one long, continuous shot of a family somewhere up in the woods where they're having a birthday party for a little girl. There's three brothers. One has his wife there. The other brother is documenting this whole thing for his film class. And then you have the mother, and you have a girlfriend of one of the other brothers. Something swoops over the house. These guys run out into the woods. They see alien creatures around a UFO, panic, run back to the house, and then a series of very frightening things occur where the aliens try to climb down the chimney and try to get in the window, and they eventually shoot one off the roof and manage to take the alien body inside. And I'd originally heard about the videotape because it was featured in Sedona magazine, the Sedona Journal of Emergence, and it was originally Tom Dongo who had actually written a piece on this video, and it had been released into the UFO community as being something that had been smuggled out of a police archive. At the very end of the videotape, the two brothers go out to get help. The brothers disappear. The girls go out and find a shotgun in the front. And now this is the alien birthday party. This is 3 years ago.
Right.
They find a shotgun in the front seat of the car. Everybody freaks out. They run back in the house. The mother screams at the boy to put the camera down. He puts the camera down in the corner. They all go in the kitchen. You see a flash of light and three aliens come in through the far door, and as they're turning the corner, supposedly to abduct and further terrorize the family, one of the aliens actually turns, looks at the camera, tilts his head, and the camera then, fuzzes and goes to static and eventually shuts off. And supposedly this videotape was all that was left behind of this family that had been abducted. Well, we'd watch this thing over and over and over again. I mean, this was something we were passing around at parties, a way to, scare the girls at the party, so to speak. And it turns out that this whole thing was, and this was something that I actually turned over to the people at Encounters, but the whole thing was done as a student project by a guy by the name of Dean Alioto, who did it with a budget of about $9,000 out of San Francisco State University. And, the whole thing was just a farcical, student project that was exceptionally well done.
Sure.
And they then did a piece on Encounters that talked about and showed Dean Alioto. Now, the strange thing is they actually still had, after Dean Alioto said, well, it's a fake, and, you know, here's the little girls that we had playing the aliens, and here's the actors and the whole thing, they actually still had people on who were saying, no, we believe that this is real, and, you know, we believe that Dean Alioto's story is being made up by the military or something. Well, here's the outrageous part, is that then Dean must have taken this videotape to Dick Clark Productions and pitched it to them, and they gave him a budget to fake this same scenario with more money, and then put these bogus experts in the thing. That one guy was a bogus special effects expert. Another guy was a bogus child psychologist saying, oh, well, the little girl seems very calm throughout this entire incident. Well, duh, because she's an actress. They had a fake sheriff on there. And then interspersed with this, you have legitimate people who I know who have done some fabulous work in the field.
Stan Friedman.
Like Daryl Sims, Stan Friedman, Yvonne Smith. And I'm watching this thing going,
huh?
Oh, my God, this is Dean Alioto's hoax. how can these people be involved in this? And after I spoke to you, I called Dick Clark Productions. We tried to actually get Dick Clark himself to come on your show, and then got stonewalled by them. But UPN, not only are they brazenly and bold-facedly putting this lion pile of junk on the air, but they've got a website, you know, do you believe the alien abduction is real?
That's right.
Press yes or no.
Yes.
They've got a 900 number that you can call that they're making money off of. Do you believe yes or no? They're going to rerun it, and
Now, having said all that, on their side, at the end of the program,
right,
they ran credits, and by God, there were actors. It said Alien 1, Alien 2, played by so-and-so.
Yep.
So anybody who was really halfway on top of it would have been very well aware that it was an acted event.
Right, but it was not presented to the public that way in the previews.
Well, as a matter of fact, they said during the program conclusively that this is real 8mm footage.
Yes. Over and over and over.
Over and over and over again. That's right.
And they said, here's our special effects expert. And at the same time, they then, and I had a conversation with Daryl Sims. I called Daryl and said, you know, did you see the video? You know, why are you involved in this? And I said, don't you realize that your credibility is probably just being blown out of the water? Because
that's right.
Daryl's one of the best people around as far as not only the, working with abductees in the abduction scenario, but also working with, people like Dr. Leo Sprinkle to actually remove implants from people.
Sure.
It was kind of a shock for me to see Stanton on there because I didn't.
Well, I covered that base. I picked up a phone, called Stanton. I said, Stanton, oh my God, what have you done? What's going on here? He said, you know what? I haven't even seen the program. He said, they brought me down there and they had me comment on abduction, which I did.
Right.
And then they took that and they interspersed my comments where they seemed relevant throughout the program. So I guess what they did was legit, but not really ethical. And Stanton says he's taken all kinds of hits and heat over this whole thing. They're attacking him like crazy.
Well, it's kind of odd because I'd never seen, I understood that Stanton was a researcher of, you know, Roswell and the Bentwaters case and some other things. I didn't realize that. I'd never seen Stanton ever do anything as far as interviewing abductees or contactees.
Right.
I'd always thought that he'd been more in the research field of coming up with government documents and all that. So it was kind of a shock for me to see Stanton commenting on abductees because I didn't realize that was a field of his expertise.
So what about Daryl? Had he seen the program or did they?
Nope, everybody was tricked, apparently.
Oh,
they were
my.
Just told that, well, we're just doing an in-general program about alien abduction. And we just want you to comment on alien abduction. And Daryl was saying that they couldn't really pull a lot of stuff from his interview, simply because he was, you know, going about it in sort of a roundabout way. I know Yvonne Smith has had a great deal of experience, probably as much as Bud Hopkins, I would think, in actually interviewing, abductees and contactees. But it's, anyway, I was just stunned. And the reason I was stunned is because, I mean, it's hard enough to actually pitch things to the network and actually get legitimate material, and then have these people not only finance a hoaxer, and I can just imagine what Dean Alioto must have pitched to Dick Clark Productions, saying, well, I did a hoax in college. Could you guys give me more money to do a better hoax on TV?
Well, and again, though, on their side, they did say, is it a hoax?
Yeah.
You know, well, maybe it's a hoax. Maybe the whole thing you're seeing here is a hoax. It was presented in that light.
But what would be the psychology behind that, Art? And would the psychology behind
one answer?
Yes, please.
Ratings.
Or?
Ratings, money.
That maybe somebody out there might actually come up with some legitimate footage of an abduction or, some legitimate alien footage and now, if somebody comes up with something legitimate or something frightening, now they've been completely diffused.
Absolutely. Of course, that could be it as well. But I think more directly, it's probably ratings and money and taking advantage of something that seems hot at the moment. I've got Dr. Roger Lear. You know Dr. Lear.
Mm-hmm.
He has removed any number of implants. He has got electron scanning photographs of a number of implants he has removed. They are on the way to me now. We'll get them on the website, and we'll try and take people down the right road with regarding with reference to the whole abduction syndrome. Now, having said what you've said about that program, and I feel the same way as you do, what about the whole abduction syndrome? I did a show on it last night. There are a lot of people who are very serious about having been abducted.
Well, I was a director and a researcher and producer on a documentary series we did back in 1990 called UFO Contactees, which later became the basis of UFO Library magazine. We traveled around for about 3 months all over the world with about $250,000 budget. I mean, interviewing contactees, abductees, scientists, researchers.
Right.
The field is so huge and so vast. Probably the best person that I had ever spoken to and become good friends with is my friend Alice Haggerty, who lives in New Jersey. And Alice not only had a pair of probes in her skull that could actually be viewed with MRI,
right,
but the ends of these probes actually came out the roof of her mouth. I mean, put a camera in her mouth, and you could see the studs from the spikes from these probes coming out the roof of her mouth.
Oh, my God.
And actually having a doctor say, well, we don't know how they got there. In order to take them out, we'd have to cut her skull open with a laser to take them out. Alice claims that she'd been, through hundreds of what initially started out as abductions and then become contacts, if you will, I guess as you get more used to the experience, and was being used as a breeder, quite literally, on the ships. She was originally one of David Jacobs' subjects, and then when David Jacobs wrote his book on it, I guess Alice sort of got kicked out of the group because she wasn't, her stories weren't, they weren't fitting in. The gray aliens, but also a very tall, about 6.5 foot tall, red-skinned, very American Indian-looking man in sort of a black cowl and medical outfit.
Huh.
She was being taken, on certain occasions, she was allowed to actually walk around the craft, where she was taken up to the bridge of the ship and shown a very large view screen, where she was being shown images of the future. So she claims, and she said she wasn't sure if they were showing this to rationalize what was happening to her, but the images of the future that she was seeing were of complete, total devastation and destruction of the planet, and that the reason this breeding program was going on was because they were genetically interbreeding or sort of interlinking humanity with their race. And the strange thing about it is that these children that they were raising on the craft, they're sort of like mall kids. I mean, they can't exist on their planet, and they can't exist on our planet. So they seem to be in this kind of rarefied environment on the craft themselves. And she wasn't really sure what it was that they were going to eventually do with them. The scenario is quite conceivably is that, number one, there's a race of beings that seems very, very interested in genetic material. They seem interested in sperm and ovum, and the primary purpose of this is to interbreed their race and their species, that they seem to be at the end of a genetic breeding cycle or curve, and the only way they can make their next step in their own evolution is by interbreeding with us, because we apparently have the power to think as individuals, and they don't. They come from sort of a collective, almost bug-like hive mind. Another aspect of this is, another theory, I might add, is that these beings might be us, and they might be coming from the future, and they're actually taking healthier genetic material along with taking water and food supplies, back to some arid earth in the future. The other aspect of this could quite simply be that they're very curious, and since their lifespan being maybe 1,000 years or so, and ours being around 100 or so, we're about a 4-year science project for them, and they can pick us up and tag us and watch us run around and pick us up again and study us over an entire lifetime, which would be approximately about a college report for one of them to find out how it is we react and how it is we behave.
All right, so the bottom line then is the abduction phenomena you think is absolutely a legitimate area of study, of research. It's real. We've just got to stick with the right people, and we've got to be very careful about what we report. And this program did not help at all.
No, because I think that eventually we're going to come up with, to give you a classic example, I mean, Daryl Sims is actively trying to videotape an abduction and videotape these things as they happen.
Sure.
And I think if somebody comes up with some kind of physical evidence of this, the other thing is too, Art, is that it's become, I mean, look at how much it's changed. Since you and I started doing these shows back in 93, look at how much the attitude has now changed.
180 degrees, no question about it. Sean, hold on. We're at the bottom of the hour. We're going to break here. When we come back, I want to ask you about the Dalai Lama. I'm Art Bell. This is Coast. Half hour, because I want to get phone lines open at the top of the hour and allow you to ask questions. So let me pummel Sean with questions. Sean, we understand you studied with the Dalai Lama. I've got somebody in the audience who wants to know what the future seems to hold for Tibet.
Oh my goodness. It's very difficult because what's the very trying period was actually predicted by the Tibetans themselves. What they call the Age of Pain or the Age of the Kali Yuga, they predicted their own demise, actually, that this type of thing would occur from China. Quite specifically, the Tibetans feel that the reason that the Red Chinese invasion actually occurred was to actually take the wisdom of Tibet, take the Dalai Lama, he of the highest wisdom, and actually then bring him out to the rest of the world. And of course, the positive effect that the Red Chinese have had was that we would have never had access to Tibetan knowledge and Tibetan learning had the invasion not occurred. The Tibetans also believe that after Tibet was destroyed and sort of pillaged and sacked by the Red Chinese, that the 3.5 million Tibetans that were killed there between 1955 and 1965, because they all took a sacred vow to instantaneously reincarnate, the vow of the Bodhisattva, which is to constantly work for the enlightenment of all sentient beings, and that in order for them to do this, that they would have to then instantaneously reincarnate somewhere where they could be of the most good. And it is the belief that there was a transmigration of souls that occurred between 1955 and 1965, and that those 3.5 million Tibetan monks and nuns were then reincarnated here in the United States, which is why you have you actually have two golden children that were born here. One was born in Boston, and another was actually born in Victorville here in California.
Victorville?
In Victorville, yes. The little boy's name is Victor Hay, and he actually lives in Victorville, and I've actually been out there to meet him, because there's four different sects. Not a lot of people realize that there's four sects of Tibetan Buddhism, the largest one being the Garden Shartse, or the Yellow Hat sect, which is what the Dalai Lama is the secular and spiritual leader of. The problem is that what the Chinese are trying to do to the Tibetans is that they're trying to breed them out of existence. They realize that by controlling, the Red Chinese have kidnapped the little boy who is called the Panchen Lama, whereas the Dalai Lama is the Sun Lama, the Panchen Lama is the Moon Lama, and it's actually the Panchen Lama that gives legitimacy to the succession of the Dalai Lama. And what the Chinese have done is they have basically brutally kidnapped the little boy who was the Panchen Lama, replaced that little boy with their own Panchen Lama, so that when this Dalai Lama dies, their plan anyway is that when this Dalai Lama dies, they will control the successor to Tenzin Gyatso, who's the current Dalai Lama.
So in other words, they will eventually, in effect, absorb Tibet. And now they've already got Hong Kong. I assume that you feel they will absorb Taiwan ultimately as well, and the Chinese will control that entire region.
I've said forever that the last great war is going to be against the Chinese, and that it's going to be the United States and Canada and this sphere of influence that the final great war. It's not going to come for another 20 years or so, but sometime around the year 2020 to 2025, the last great war is the United States versus China.
When?
In 2020 to 2025. It's another 20 years. That's why it's just so obscene that we're handing them weapons and nuclear arms and submarines and technology and giving them our databases and our patent databases. I think it's obscene that we're arming them as another enemy now that the Russians have collapsed. The military-industrial complex is trying to bring the Red Chinese back up to parity so that they can start the Cold War all over again, because the Cold War is the best of all possible scenarios, because you're spending billions, trillions of dollars on defense without actually having a war.
The military industrial complex depends on it.
Yes.
All right. Moving along, the Millennium crash. Now, one night I put in the year 2000 into my computer.
Yes.
I did not reboot the computer, which everybody said would have been a tragic mistake. I just let it sit there and let the time hack go on my photograph that went up there to show everybody it could be done. But I'm being told now that this is a really serious problem, and that when the clock clicks and it becomes 2000, computers everywhere are going to go bonkers. What's going to happen?
Well, it's not the year 2000, actually. It's going to be for 37 states that actually have the older mainframe computers. It's actually going to be July 1 of 1999, which is when their fiscal year begins.
Ah.
And then it's going to be October 1st, or 1001. 99 for the federal government, because that's when their fiscal year begins. Now, I did a newsletter on this it was back in October, where I did an entire Millennium crash newsletter. Specifically what's going on is that as I'm sure many of your listeners know, is that when the computers hit the double zero, that the older mainframes that the Federal Reserve uses, that most of the banks in the United States and in fact the world use, the computers that the Internal Revenue Service uses, the computers that the Social Security uses, are simply going to go tilt. And the thing is that Social Security started trying to fix the problem back in 1989. To give you an idea, Social Security needs to rewrite 30 million lines of code within the next 2 years. Since 1989, they have managed to rewrite approximately 6 million lines of code. The Internal Revenue Service needs to rewrite 65 million lines of code. And guess what, Art? They haven't even started. They have not even started.
Aww.
They have laid it out to TRW. I mean, my dad was vice president of TRW for years and years. And, he gave me some of the inside scoop on this. They laid it out to TRW, to Microsoft, to McDonnell Douglas, to Northrop even. Some of the biggest computer firms there are, and the government is now expecting that these companies are to lay out $200 to $500 million of their own money up front to fix the government's problem. In other words, the government's not going to pay them until they fix the problem.
Well, what is the real net effect for people? I mean, are my IRS records going to suddenly be scrambled and destroyed, or what?
Yep. And your Social Security and any mutual funds and bank accounts and credit cards.
I could cease to exist.
Yeah. But here's the trick, though. What are they going to use? Everybody's saying, oh, well, this is great, and I'm going to cease to exist, and, isn't it wonderful that the government's not doing anything about this? Of course, the guy that they've just put in as the new commissioner of the IRS, for the first time in the history of the IRS, is not a tax attorney or a tax accountant. He's a computer programmer. All he's trying to do is actually keep the IRS working. And the reports that have been put out over the Internet is that they just want to try to keep the Internal Revenue Service in business. Not even talking about collecting new taxes, but it's not only the fact that they have to rewrite the code, and there are not enough programmers now in the world that speak the COBOL code and speak all these various languages, but it's also that the tax code is not in one place. It's spread out through 10 regional offices, which means that they have to now get the malleable, constantly changing tax code all in one place to do this. The bottom line is, not only can they not fix it, they are not going to fix it, and they don't want to fix it, because it's my belief that what's going to happen is they are going to allow Social Security to go under, they're going to allow the IRS to go under, they're going to allow the Federal Reserve to go under, but what are they going to replace it with? And I think that they are going to replace it initially with the smart cards. And the smart cards are going to have the computer chips in them. This is where they're going to bring in the supercomputers that have been developed at Area 51, and this is where it gets really freaky.
So, in other words, those of us who want to continue to exist will take the number.
Yes. Well, this is where it gets even stranger, Art, is the computers that they have out at Area 51, the supercomputers,
right,
are called beast computers. And the reason that they're called beast computers is because it stands for Battle Engagement Area Simulation and Tracking. And the Battle Engagement Area Simulation and Tracking computers are space-based, and what they do is that they are designed to track troops on the ground, so that they put the chip in your buttocks, or they put it in the back of your hand or your forehead. And the reason the chip goes there is because the galvanetic responses of the skin, your body changes temperature more frequently in those two areas, the back of the hand and the forehead.
Right.
And it's the body changes in temperature that actually power the chip. So what happens is that the chips are actually called MARCs, M-A-R-C-C, which is Multiple Automated Readout Computer Chip. This is what these things are called. They're also called Tessera. And the Tessera was a slave tag. It's where we get the word boss from, or to emboss someone into service. The Tessera systems were used in the Roman Empire, that when you became a slave, you got your hair shaved off, they took away your shoes, and then you had to wear a Tessera or a tag showing whose house you belonged to, in order, or whose slave you were, in essence, in order to be able to travel within the Roman Empire, run your errands on a day-to-day basis. So the Tessera system that goes to the battle engagement area simulation tracking computers, that goes to the MARC chips specifically, were designed initially for the military because they put these things usually behind the carotid artery for Black Berets or Navy SEALs or Airborne Rangers. And when you go into, like, Iraq for a wet operation, let's say you're wounded, they can track you with the chip to get you out. Once, let's say you're unconscious, they put a laser gun up to the side of your head, they hit it, they come up with all of your medical records so that an evac doctor can treat you right away.
Mm-hmm.
It can be used as a communications device, or if you're captured and they want plausible deniability, it pops open and there's a corrosive acid in it that burns through the carotid artery, and then your head just floods with blood, and poof, you're done. You're instantly disposable military hardware.
So in other words, this great crisis that people have talked to me about for so long that will cause us all to willingly, in quotes, take the number, is no great mystery at all. As a matter of fact, we know about it right now, we know when it's going to occur, and we know the net effect of the crisis, and we're all going to take that number.
Absolutely. And I think, well, not all of us, but I think that that is where the battle lines are going to be drawn. And I think that, for example, this year is fascinating because 1998, if you divide 1998 by the three of the Trinity, you come up with 666 for 1998. If you look at the time coding of the Great Pyramid at Giza, it talks about the central messianic figure, or Christ, it points to the exact location where he was born, as being born September 17th of 2 BC. So actually, the real millennium as we know it actually begins in September of 1998. The pyramid then says, if you understand the time coding, that by February of 1999 is when the kingdom of heaven comes to earth, and it's my belief that by that time, that's when the battle lines are going to be drawn, because I think the kingdom of heaven is actually a new type of political and economic system that is formed by people coming out of society and refusing to take this mark. And over and over and over again, biblically, it says you're not supposed to get tattoos, you're not supposed to defile
right.
your skin,
that's right.
you're not to take a mark or a number upon the skin. And I think a lot of people are finally going to realize that that this is the thing that's being put into place, and I think it's going to start at first with the smart cards. Then there's going to be a major food crisis or banking crisis where the smart cards are going to be stolen and they're going to be too valuable, and they're going to put the chip in your hand or on your forehead. And if you look in the book of Revelations, not to get biblical on you.
No, that's all right.
But it basically talks about the very first plague in the book of Revelations of the vials that are actually broken open. The first plague comes to anyone who actually gets this chip or this mark, where they get a disease that looks very much like radiation poisoning, that something leaks in the power source system of this particular chip and makes your skin bubble in a sort of a horrible leprous manner, so that everybody that actually takes this chip after, and it gives a very specific period of time, and I think it's Revelation 15, of about between 8 months, 8 and 18 months, that your skin begins to bubble and everybody who takes the chip will be struck with this plague.
Boy, are you on your mark this morning. Listen, I'll hit you with this. I interviewed Zai Awas for 2 hours.
Oh, how is Zai?
He's just fine.
Oh,
the
good.
Director of Antiquities, of course, for Giza. And you know what he announced on my program?
What's that?
That he is about to close the Great Pyramid for 6 months.
Yeah, they're supposedly going to clean it or something.
Do you see anything else there? I've never heard of this.
Well, they were going to close it. I did hear that they were closing it between November of 1999 and February of 2000. I had also heard something rather ominous that there was apparently a very wealthy, very powerful group that had actually rented the Giza Plateau, literally given the Egyptian government a chunk of money. I haven't confirmed that. But it's pretty weird. I mean, I actually saw the hole that everybody is talking about. I'm very good friends with people on the Giza Plateau. I went to the British International School in Cairo when I was a kid. One of my best friends, his brother, was a guard on the Giza Plateau for years and years and years. So I've got a pretty good insight. I met with Zahi when I was there. I guess you're taking a boat trip with him very soon, aren't
you? That's right. That's right,
man. You're going to Alaska with him, aren't you?
That's correct, for a grand debate.
With a whole bunch of other experts that I hope Zahi makes it back alive, actually.
I hope I make it back alive.
The only area or location that is of interest now is that there is sort of a diamond-shaped crack in the floor in the Sphinx Temple complex, not by the Sphinx, but actually to the right of the Sphinx's paw, down a couple of hundred yards or so. There's a locked gate where I actually got access into this locked gate, and you know they just have a big rock on top of it, and you move this rock, and it's about the size of a manhole where you can actually go down into this. When I was there in December of 96. It had actually been flooded out. They'd had some flooding in Cairo, so you couldn't get down into it. But this was the area where Zahi Hawass went down. You can go towards the pyramid about 100 yards or so.
That's right.
And there's a big sort of red block, like a stone door. And this is where Zahi made his famous videotape where he's standing in front of this stone block saying, oh, Indiana Jones would wish that he would be here. And,
I have that tape.
Yeah, and that's the hole. But that's it. I mean, the only other thing that I see happening in Cairo, I mean, you know, once again, Edgar Cayce predicted that by the end of 1998 that they would find the Lost Library of Atlantis somewhere down there. Well, they're not going to do it with the help of the Egyptian government. They're not going to do it. Nobody that I know of has been given a grant or permission to do anything really on the plateau. The only way to find out what's down there is to actually, under cover of, say, like a music video or doing something else, actually doing a sounding of the plateau. And we have the technology now. As a matter of fact, Jim Dellatoso developed it to actually sound the plateau, run it through a supercomputer, and then data table it to find out exactly what's under there. And you wouldn't need the permission of the government to do that. You just basically play sound, around the outside of the plateau, and it's
sure.
Totally non-invasive.
Well, you've got to wonder what they're going to be doing for a half year with nothing but private access.
That's very strange. The only other thing I can think of is, and I've said this for quite some time, is that if the Lost Library of Atlantis is going to be found, then it's going to be an earthquake that's going to crack it open. That's the only thing I see happening. And if there's an earthquake in Cairo, and of course earthquake activity has increased over the last few years, it's a 500-year cycle now. The last great earthquake that destroyed much of the city of Cairo happened in, 1506 A.D.,
could happen again.
Yeah, and happen again and shatter the right shoulder of the Sphinx. But that's the only way that they're going to find anything under there, because they're not going to do it with the help of the Egyptian government or with the help of the Supreme Council of Antiquities, because if you even mention Atlantis, they go crazy, that it's an American hallucination, that there's no proof of it.
Oh, I know. I mentioned it to Zahi, and it drives him right through the roof.
Crazy. Because they've had all these Edgar Cayce people crawling all over him, and he's saying, you know, there's no evidence, there's no such thing, we haven't found anything, it's a big lie.
I am really surprised that Zahi has agreed to meet with Graham Hancock and Robert Bouval and Danyon Brinkley and all those who are going to challenge him, and it's going to be quite a chore to try and keep everybody from throwing everybody else.
Killing each other, yeah. It's just that, you know, they've all been at each other's throats for such a long time. Although in defense of Zahi, I see it from his point of view. The pyramids belong to everyone. They're very much an international thing. If he was to allow, say, the Americans to go in and start drilling holes and doing things, pyramids would go crazy.
I know.
The European community would say, oh my God, those crazy Americans, they're going to destroy everything for this big myth. And he's absolutely right. Nobody has been able to present him with any empirical evidence or information that there's anything underneath the Giza Plateau. But at the same time, he's not letting them look for anything either. So, considering the fact that he still won't let the German professor with the Upawat go up the star shaft again, with another robot to find out what's underneath the...
Oh, I got a call from Guttenbrink the other day, as a matter of fact.
Oh, Guttenbrink, yeah, okay.
And well, we're going to get him on the air and do an interview. Also, hold on, Sean. One other thing I want to tell you is that the two-hour program we did with Zaya Wass is in the process of being reversed by David Oates, so we'll have that for you shortly. When we come back, yes, there's going to be... Sean, welcome back again. I want to hit this UFO mothership. I mean, that's a serious prediction for this year, a gigantic sort of Independence Day-type size ship to appear over a major U.S. city in broad daylight this year?
Well, actually, it's already happened. I'm surprised that you haven't covered it. If you remember when I was on your show on March 13th, they had the wave of motherships that were flying over Phoenix, and those motherships returned January 11th, 12th, 13th, and 14th over Phoenix.
That's right.
You haven't heard about it really too much in the news yet.
Oh, no. I did cover it. It's just that they said again it was flares, Sean, flares.
Well...
Not flares.
I had a conversation with Jim Dellatoso, who is, he lives right there in Phoenix in Paradise Valley, and the only reason Jim hasn't gone more public with it than he has is because he's working on a top-secret computer project for TRW at the moment, and they're under a, I guess what you would call a sort of an email lockdown. And, Jim has been the one that's been leading the... has been leading the public town halls there in Phoenix and has been doing most of the investigation. And of course, you know, computer analysis, it's very easy to tell the difference between flares and between some other light source. Apparently the wave began, on January 11th. There's some excellent photographs and video. There was approximately, this is once again according to Jim Dellatoso, about 14 craft. The smallest one was about 1.7 miles across. The largest one was 22 miles across. The ships, ominously enough, are shaped like gigantic alpha and omegas. In other words, they're huge A shapes, and then the other ships are sort of oblong loop shapes, almost exactly like the craft that you saw in Independence Day that were sort of discs that then have... two immense fins coming off the back of the back of the craft. And when I was talking about it, which was December 28th on your last show, and I said that, you know, watch for this. I mean, I do believe that this phenomenon is going to continue. I was actually quoted as saying Phoenix about 3 days later on another radio program that I was doing. And, when it started happening in January.
Why Phoenix?
I don't know. I have no idea. I asked Jim... You know, why Phoenix and what he thinks it is. Jim's opinion was that he seems to think that the lights that they somehow focus on Phoenix, literally focusing on an electromagnetic vortex there. Now they don't start in Phoenix. They start apparently up near Paulden, and closer to Sedona, where of course Sedona's been famous for having vortexes and a lot of activity for a long time. They seem to begin up there, and then they move back and forth, up and down the state. Jim's opinion is that these beings were, and, you know, I don't exactly know how he knew this, but I just asked him, what's your opinion of what you think they are? He says they seem to actually focus in on the electromagnetic frequency of the place, focusing in on the rocks and the trees and the water. He says the lights come in first, and you actually have a focus on these lights that appear around the edges of the craft. Then the craft itself then phases in to our reality and then hovers there for a period of anywhere between 10 minutes and the 22-mile cross craft.
All right, then that accounts for why some people see only lights with nothing in the middle and other people see a manifestation when it appears of the solid object that fills in.
Yes, because Jim says that the solid object then fades in. He says they hang there for anywhere between 10 minutes to about half an hour. He was saying that this last time, now in the March sightings, the military didn't react at all. They sent up one jet and I think a helicopter and that was about it. He says this time they're investigating whether or not the military actually shot missiles at this one, and the missiles then disintegrated, whether or not they actually... And they sent up this time a lot of helicopters and a lot of jets, and began dropping flares all the way around the perimeter of the city as a distraction. And Jim then says that the craft then materialized fully, hang for anywhere between 10 minutes to half an hour, and then go back into a stealth mode. Now, in my conversations with contactees, specifically my friend Alex Collier and my friend Audrey Ain, who's the Pleiadian contactee who's in Germany now, you know, they've got a whole explanation. I will just relate, you know, I don't know. I'm not a contactee or an abductee or any kind of E. I'm just a phenomenologist who researches this type of material.
Mm-hmm.
According to them, they say that these craft are Alpha Draconian motherships, that they have been blasted into this particular time-space reality because there is a war or a conflict of some kind going on this planet, apparently between a very, very high-level good force and a very high-level bad force, and that they've closed down the spaceways, if you will, that they've actually closed down the time-space doorways, which when these craft actually try to escape and actually try to transcend time-space, go into another dimension, if you will, they sort of hit a brick wall, which brings them back down into our reality, which forces them to then materialize, and that the reason they're moving up and down the state of Arizona and New Mexico also along the borders is because they're actually looking for a way out. They're looking for a vortex that's been closed. Now, the only other thing I can tell you from my experience is that I did have a conversation with a very high level general. I'm good friends with people like Gordon Cooper and Edgar Mitchell, and a lot of the astronauts were my dad's best friends because he was a public relations director for NASA. And I've got a couple of godfathers who walked on the moon, so I get to talk to these people. And a 4-star general who I can't mention, but telling me that there is a military conflict going on this planet, but that it is being handled by, quote, an agency higher than the United States government and higher than the U.S. military.
My goodness.
Unquote.
All right, look, we could do an entire program on almost any of these subjects, but I've got to keep going here.
Okay.
Here is another fax. Somebody very much enjoying the show asking, Sean, please discuss your soon-to-be-released book, Area 51, Nightmare in Dreamland. What exactly is covered in the book, and what is the thesis?
Oh, well, been working on this book for about a year now. It's being published by M. Evans. I'm about 3 weeks away from finally completing the book itself. The thesis of the book was just when we'd originally interviewed Bob Lazar directly after, who was the scientist who defected from Area 51, right after George Knapp got through with him in 89.
Right.
We spoke to him about 3 months later. Interviewed Lazar, and it took about a year for me to then go out to Area 51. I took the LA Times out there with me. It was Wednesday night, February 26th of 1991. I'd never seen a UFO before in my life. And, we had one of these craft literally swoop over the car, almost hit the car in the middle of the road, and myself and a friend of mine ran after this thing in the desert and had quite an experience watching this. And, of course, over the course of between 1991 and early part of 1993, we began to get so many people that wanted to go out there with us that we would go out on Wednesday nights. We would camp out right near the military border, and from about 6:30 to 9:30, the military would then put on a show in which there were discs that were skipping up and down the valley and doing all kinds of maneuvers.
That's right.
And then it was May 30th of 1991 that I actually climbed up Whitesides Mountain and actually found this hill that looked down on the base, which I kept to myself for about 6 months. I took John Lear up in December of 91. John said, "Oh, my God, how'd you find this hill and not be dead? How did they not kill you after finding this hill?" And then Lear was the one who then told everybody else. And, it's kind of a shame because there's one other book out on the market, which is called, it's really nonsense. It's called The Dreamland Chronicles, and it's basically written by people who showed up after 1993 to 94, who were all people who came down to Area 51 when all the saucers had been moved, when there was no more phenomenon. And we didn't see a thing after the spring of 93. And I told people as much, and I said, I don't want to take people out there or have much more to do with it because, I'm not concerned with whether or not the military is developing new rockets or new jets. I'm concerned with the fact that they've got anti-gravity and they're testing it. It was fun to go out and watch and to see. So the thesis of the book is actually starts out at Area 51, starts with the German science starting in the 20s and 30s. What happened to that German science? Did it go to South America? Did it go to the South Pole? Was there some sort of interaction between Germany and extraterrestrials? I've got some actual photos in the book that were taken by my friend Audrine, who went to this base in South America and photographed landed UFOs on the ground being worked on by these 7.5-foot-tall men. We've got a very interesting thing in there about Adolf Hitler and what eventually happened to him.
If the discs have been moved from Area 51, then why annex more land around the area?
Because they in 1993, they upped the troop strength. They put, there were about 5,000 more personnel that moved in there. And I think it's just, it was just a matter of honor and pride on the part of the military. You know, they just didn't want to be messed with, and they just had to respond somehow. But you know, as far as actual sightings go, I mean, sure, there could be saucers still there. George Knapp has it on very good authority that the actual S4 complex has been completely dismantled. Mm. You know, we found out as much from our friend Victor when we interviewed him, you know, a few months ago, that the S4 complex was pretty much gone. Area 51 itself has sort of reverted to, you know, low-tech ramjet and scramjet stuff. And now even the National Aerospace Plane has been moved to, I think it's Area 6314 up in Utah. But the flying saucers themselves have probably been moved to Pine Gap, Australia. And it was my contention back in 1993 that the majority of the flying saucer stuff at Area 51 was actually moved to a location outside of Tucson. And then, of course, now you've got all of these, you know, incredible UFO sightings over Phoenix and Tucson.
Of course.
So that's what I've been saying for a long time.
All right, look, not a lot of time before the bottom of the hour, but we must have you comment on what apparently we're staring down the throat of with Iraq. Something is about to happen with Iraq. What do you see occurring? When do you see it occurring? Will there be biologicals used? Will there be chemicals used? Will Tel Aviv still be there? What's going to happen?
Okay, this is the big thing with Iraq. We have been tracking, and I've got to give Robert Egan credit on this, because Robert and I both tear apart the Nostradamus quatrains with a metalinguistic decoding technique. It's very complex, and I'm not even going to get into it, but what we've been tracking is a third round of hostilities with Iraq. We've been tracking this for about 6 months. These third round of hostilities with Iraq is going to result in an anthrax attack, specifically by the Iraqis against targets in the Middle East and here in the United States. The biggest thing that I'm worried about, we are going to send cruise missiles. It's all going to break loose in just a little bit over 10 days to 14 weeks. What we're waiting for now is for a fourth aircraft carrier from England to actually reach the Persian Gulf. Once that aircraft carrier gets there, we're going to be launching a substantial cruise missile attack against the Iraqis.
Okay, that makes sense. I'm sure we would
do that. The thing I'm most afraid of is that we, and I pray to God that this doesn't happen, but I would say that there's probably a 75% likelihood that we will use low-grade tactical nuclear weapons.
I knew it. In other words, they use anthrax, they use some other biological agent, we answer with nukes.
Well, but these nukes are what they call Excalibur nukes, and what the Excalibur nukes do is that they climb on a spike, and then they come in at a 45-degree angle, and they've got boron noses on the front of these things, and what they do is when they strike the ground, they drill several hundred feet into the ground and actually deliver the nuclear kilotonnage hundreds of feet underground.
Bunker busters.
Bunker busters, right. And those are the tactical nuclear weapons that they're going to be using against the Iraqis. And remember, we're going into this fight on our own. We do not have the help of any of the Arab republics like we did in Desert Storm.
That's right.
We do not have the support of the Russians, the French, the Germans. The Iraqis, as far as the European community is concerned, have done every single thing that the United Nations has asked them to do. The Europeans want the embargo lifted. The price of oil was plummeting in the United States. And, of course, what do? We go over there and smack the Iraqis around in order to raise the price of oil here in the U.S. And, of course, you know, do I hear Wag the Dog in there somewhere?
You know, David Oates did a reversal on the president that said something like, the hell with Earth, the desert will answer. And I wonder if it might have some relationship to what you see occurring in the Middle East. I certainly hope not.
That's exactly what's going to go on. But what's going to happen is that after this last round of smacking the Iraqis around, you're going to see the collapse of Saddam Hussein's regime. And I think I think that by the beginning of 1999, we might actually have a fairly positive relationship with the Iraqis.
All right. All right. Hold tight. We'll be right back. Sean David Morton is my guest, and we are going to phones when we return. Stay right where you are. This is Coast to Coast AM.
Great. Okay. Thank you. Yeah, I just wanted to let everybody know that the Delphi Associates newsletter is very, very much a corroborative effort. Not only is it my visions and intuitions, but I work with a crack team of Nostradamus experts and astrologers and other psychics and sensitives, and I try to feature their work as well as my own. The Delphi Associates newsletter is the newsletter you have to have today because it tells you all about tomorrow. Let me give everybody the hotline number first, and then I'll give you the address and the cost of the newsletter. The hotline number is 310-217-7579. That's 310-217-7579. And you can call the hotline, and that will just give you all the information that you need. The Delphi Associates newsletter, you for $50, which is the cost, you get 12 issues of the newsletter. It's published by PRI, the Prophecy Research Institute. So you can make your $50 check or money order out to PRI, Prophecy Research Institute, and please mail it to, the address is 2207, that's 2207, Hermosa Avenue, H-E-R-M-O-S-A, and that's in beautiful Hermosa Beach, California, and our zip code is 90254. Once again, it's $50, make your checks out to PRI, the Prophecy Research Institute. That's for a 12-issue subscription of the newsletter. And once again, we're located at 2207 Hermosa Avenue, H-E-R-M-O-S-A. It means beautiful in Spanish. And that's in Hermosa Beach, California. And the zip code is 90254. And once again, our hotline number is 310-217-7579.
Is that a 24-hour number?
Yes, it is, 24-hour number. And I want to also, to those who are subscribing to the newsletter, our predictions for 1998 newsletter is a couple of weeks late just because I've had this terrible flu for the last 3 weeks and I haven't been able to work on it. So I've just finished it over the last couple of days, and so everybody who does subscribe to the newsletter from your show should be getting it within the next week or so.
All right. On that front, on the flu front, yeah, that's right. I've got to ask one last question. I had it. It was horrible. I wasn't even sure I was going to make it through it. My wife had it. Same deal. Horrible.
Art, how did you get it? You know, you're out in the middle of no place.
Nobody knows. Nobody knows. And the strange thing is, I got it first. My wife goes out occasionally, right?
I mean, the radio station's in like a, you know, biological clean room, isn't it? I mean, you,
absolutely.
Your house looks like something out of the Andromeda Strain.
Absolutely.
How did you pick up the flu?
Unknown. And so I guess I would ask you, what do you see coming on that front? We've got this horrid flu making the rounds. Talked to a doctor earlier tonight. Hospital beds are all full. It's getting worse and worse and worse. You look at CNN, the flu report warnings are everywhere now. It's descending on us. It seems to be getting just worse and worse and worse.
Well, that was I hate to sound like a busted record, but that was something that we talked about on the show on December 28th also. I said, you know,
right,
watch for this flu epidemic, that things carry through the air. The establishment explanation for this is that it's an Australian flu. There's no immunity for it, apparently, because as it was explained to me by the doctor when I went to go see him, and of course all they do is poke you and say, well, I don't know what's wrong with it, here, take some of these.
Yep.
It's antibiotics don't seem to work on it. There's a couple of the only treatments that I know of are something called Essiac tea. And there's also an herb which is called elecampane root, which I was taking for it. That's E-L-E-C-A-M-P-A-N-E, elecampane root, which seems to help the coughing. But it's completely resistant to antibiotics, or at least the antibiotics we've got. Usually, because Australia's summer is our winter, these drug companies go down to Australia and pick up strains of the flu viruses down there, and then come up with flu shots for them, and then come back up to the United States. And
somehow they missed Sydney type A.
And they supposedly missed it, right. Well, you know, once again, I will reiterate, the rather suspicious nature of this flu is this is a fifth incarnation or a strain of the original Spanish influenza virus, which killed 25 million people approximately 86 years ago. between 1918 and about 1922. The World Health Organization, a year and a half ago, and this was in Omni magazine and on the front page of the LA Times, were digging up Spanish flu victims, Irish Spanish flu victims, were pulling the virus out of their lungs and growing Spanish influenza in laboratories because, strangely enough, there was no immunity to this particular type of flu.
We have lost our minds.
And they were worried that this flu would actually get out and that there would be no immunity to it. And, of course, people get infected with it. And, you know, the World Health Organization and the Center for Disease Control are already rather suspicious organizations, if you believe the accusation of what's going on with the AIDS virus, et cetera, et cetera. So I just saw, I thought it was, and I remember printing it in the newsletter thinking, oh my God, are we insane? What the hell are we doing? And you watch if this flu doesn't break out or somehow either get out of the laboratory or is somehow purposely injected into the population. I mean, what I've seen in the future, as far as the long-term aspect of this, is that there are great plagues that sweep the world and kill millions of people between 2005 and about 2009 or so. But that's, you know, a long ways off. You are seeing right now the beginning of these plagues, of which there's going to be one after another after another after another, of which it just seems that it's just not going to end.
Now, you do predict a cure for a serious sexual disease, possibly AIDS?
It's going to be, here's the biggest thing about this year. Right now, as a matter of fact, I think it's very unique that you and I are speaking tonight. Something always amazing always happens when you and I connect.
Is that
yesterday, we had Neptune move into Aquarius for the first time since 1833. So for the first time in well over 150 years or so, we have Neptune in Aquarius, we have the Sun conjuncting Aquarius, we've got Uranus in Aquarius. So the biggest thing that's going to go on is going to have to do with electromagnetism. Now, and here's the difficult part, Art. You and I both know that there are cures for these various diseases out there. That there are electromagnetic cures, that there are various types of cures for AIDS, for virtually everything that ails mankind.
That's right.
It's just a question of, is the establishment going to find it in their lexicon, so to speak, to allow these to trickle down to us, you know, peasants at the bottom of the strain. You know, my mother is president of the National Health Federation for 22 years. My stepfather ran a number of anti-cancer clinics down in Tijuana, the Clinica Seidel and the Good Samaritan Clinic he owned. So I know that there are cures for this. It's just a question of when legitimate medicine is going to open up. Now, the biggest thing that's going to happen this year is you're going to see advances in electromagnetic medicine. Already they're using prototypes of a type of electromagnet that is actually curing epilepsy. They're basically going to find that, and this is down the road, but that all disease has a very specific frequency, that it has a light, a color, and a frequency.
Sure.
And you can actually shatter that disease by simply bombarding the body with the opposite frequency.
Well, they'd better get to it. The way it's going, they better get to it.
And
listen, you're going to be on hard copy as a result of your appearance on this program and your prediction about the president. When are you going to be on hard copy, and what did they cover?
It's going to be Monday.
Monday.
I'm going to be on hard copy. As a matter of fact, Wayne Darwin, who's the producer on it, is a friend of mine. He actually took over Strange Universe after I left and Burt Kearns moved in. We're also going to be covering the Phoenix Lights thing. We're going back out to Phoenix to try to get all of the new stuff of what was going on from January 11th to the 14th of the motherships over Phoenix again. And specifically what we covered is, you know, we talked about Clinton. We talked about how he was inaugurated in the void of course moon, that he'd be out of office again, I think, by August. And a lot of the similarities between Nixon and the conflict of this is that there are great plagues that sweep the world and kill millions of people between 2005 and about 2009 or so, but that's, you know, a long ways off. You are seeing right now the beginning of these plagues, of which there's going to be one after another after another after another, of which it just seems that it's just not going to end.
Now, you do predict a cure for a serious sexual disease, possibly AIDS?
It's going to be, here's the biggest thing about this year. right now, as a matter of fact, I think it's very unique that you and I are speaking tonight. Something always amazing always happens when you and I connect. Is that yesterday we had Neptune move into Aquarius for the first time since 1833. So for the first time in well over 150 years or so, we have Neptune in Aquarius, we have the Sun conjuncting Aquarius, we've got Uranus in Aquarius. So the biggest thing that's going to go on is going to have to do with electromagnetism. Now, and here's the difficult part, Art. You and I both know that there are cures for these various diseases out there, that there are electromagnetic cures, that there are various types of cures for AIDS, for virtually everything that ails mankind.
That's right.
It's just a question of, is the establishment going to find it in their lexicon, so to speak, to allow these to trickle down to us, you know, peasants at the bottom of the strain. You know, my mother is president of the National Health Federation for 22 years. My stepfather ran a number of anti-cancer clinics down in Tijuana, the Clinica Seidel and the Good Samaritan Clinic he owned. So I know that there are cures for this. It's just a question of when legitimate medicine is going to open up. Now, the biggest thing that's going to happen this year is you're going to see advances in electromagnetic medicine. Already, they're using prototypes of a type of electromagnet that is actually curing epilepsy. They're basically going to find that, and this is down the road, but that all disease has a very specific frequency, that it has a light, a color, and a frequency.
Sure.
And you can actually shatter that disease by simply bombarding the body with the opposite frequency.
Well, they better get to it. The way it's going, they better get to it.
And listen,
you're going to be on hard copy as a result of your appearance on this program and your prediction about the president. When are you going to be on hard copy, and what did they cover?
It's going to be Monday.
Monday.
I'm going to be on hard copy. As a matter of fact, Wayne Darwin, who's the producer on it, is a friend of mine. He actually took over Strange Universe after I left and Burt Kearns moved in. We're also going to be covering the Phoenix Lights thing. We're going back out to Phoenix to try to get all of the new stuff of what was going on from January 11th to the 14th of the motherships over Phoenix again. And specifically what we covered is, you know, we talked about Clinton. We talked about how he was inaugurated in the void of course moon, that he'd be out of office again, I think, by August, and a lot of the similarities between Nixon and Clinton. I pointed out the things with the plane, where they're going to do a thing on that, where the Air Force One, he was then transferred to the 707 that Nixon went on after he resigned, and then the next 707 he transferred on was the one that JFK's body was flown from Dallas. So all
of that's going to get covered.
Yeah, that's another thing they're going to cover, and just a lot of the similarities between Monica Lewinsky coming out of Watergate and Nixon getting tied up with tapes and Clinton getting tied up with tapes. I said again that, you know, on the show the last time, that I think that Clinton's going to resign due to health reasons, heart attack, nervous breakdown. You know, he's going to, once again, one thing after another after another after another is going to happen, which is what's going to eventually bring him down.
All right, let's go to the phones. Wildcard Line, you're on the air with Sean David Morton. Hello.
Hello, and what an interesting guest, and what an exciting life you lead.
me or Art? Art leads the exciting life. I sit in my house and write.
Well, you know what I was wondering, Sean? You quickly mentioned something about they wondered what really happened to Hitler. I just caught that when you were talking. That would be interesting to know what you think.
Okay, well, I mean, I'll give you what I discovered in the book just real quickly. I had a chance to interview Helga Christensen, who was Hitler's personal secretary, about 6 weeks before she died. And I also interviewed another woman named Magda Stapleford, who lives in Tucson, who was the number three person in the SS, who then defected to our OSS directly after the war and actually married her opposite number in the OSS. According to her, she says that Hitler, Bormann, and one other high official were surgically altered in September of 1943, and that they were then smuggled out of the country through Bremerhaven, and he supposedly was given sanctuary. Both Bormann and Hitler were both given sanctuary by the Vatican, and Hitler then disappears and actually lives in Vatican City. Actually directed the archives there, which allowed him to then process, you know, literally billions of dollars in priceless artwork, and he pops up as a priest in a a place called Cuenca, Ecuador.
Wait a minute. What about the bunker? What about the fire?
No, it's all suicide. There were four, according to Magda, there were actually four doubles of Hitler that were not only surgically altered to look like him, but also they had their bones broken in the exact same place. But that Hitler never, after September of 1943, Hitler never gave a public address, not once. And that's because Hitler was long gone. Anyway, as just to make a long story short, supposedly, and one of the photographs that I'm going to be running in the book, and probably something I might want to send you, Art, to put up on your website, is an actual photograph of this man, Father Crespi, and I'm telling you, it's him. I mean, it's...
Send me the photograph.
The ears are the same, the eyes are the same. The only thing that's different is that he chose a very large, Semitic-looking nose, which is what they... which is what they altered his face with. And when Father Crespi died in, he was 102. He died in 1993. He was sitting on, probably $1 billion worth of artwork, 4,000, priceless pieces of art that had been looted, you know, that literally had the Louvre and, various designations, embedded directly on the backs of the piece of art. And they were loaded in a couple of Vatican 707s and shipped back to the Vatican when he died in 1933.
Enough said. Right. Get me that photograph. I'll get it up on the website. And by the way, while we're on the subject, isn't it about time that you got a website?
Yeah, I know. It's all this 20th century stuff. I suppose I'll eventually get one. A lot of people have been saying, Sean, get a website. But it's just, I don't know. I'll get there. As soon as I can figure out a way to maybe make some money off a website, I'll figure out how to do it.
All right, and I've got a very good webmaster. Call him. He'll fix you up.
Oh, perfect.
In the meantime, get it to me, and we'll get it up there, of course. East of the Rockies, you're on the air with Sean David Morton. Hello.
Yes, good morning. This is Frank from Ocean City, Maryland.
Hi,
yes,
Frank.
Good morning. I hope you gentlemen are well.
Oh, well, we're coughing, but we're okay.
Yeah.
That's well, so am I. I'm just getting over. Not the flu. I was lucky. I just had a bad cold. But I'm going to throw something by you with your success, Sean David, in predictions. I've ran this through my mind over the period of years now. And if you look at Revelation, and it looks like we're really going into the area of time just prior to Revelations when you're looking at the floods, you know, the incident of major earthquakes, droughts, the crazy weather. It's been 48, 50 degrees here for the last 3 weeks
right.
in midwinter. Isn't it not the weight of an object, let's say an object, plus the distribution of the weight of the object, and we're talking about the Earth now,
mm-hmm.
plus the speed of the object that keeps it in orbit?
Yes.
You know, if the weight decreases, would not the orbit decay throwing the object, the sphere, into space or draw it into the sun or cause it to begin to wobble and destroy itself?
Well, if the weight decreases, but, you know, the planet is always going to be two-thirds water, one-third land.
Well, what I'm getting at, if you look at over the period of years with the billions upon billions upon billions of tons of oil and coal... precious metals.
Oh, yes.
Yes, but the mass, though, remains the same. We may burn it. It just changes.
Yeah, it changes, and then it just sort of drips back into the, you know, I don't think it floats out into space.
Now, if you want to ask about Earth changes and earthquakes, Sean, what do you have to say about that? What's coming?
Well, we went into that. I need to get my notes out again because we went into that on the show the last time.
Generally going to be active?
This year is going to be actually relatively mild, as I said. One of the things that I was talking about was the a couple of interesting things that are happening that we talked about the last time. The first thing is I talked about that that flu in Alaska. I wrote down the name of it, but there was just a series of earthquakes there just today, actually. There's also... I talked about a place by the name called Kalog in the Yukon near Kalog, fires in August, earthquake activity in the Aleutians near Port Mahler. There was some substantial activity actually there today, and I think that that's a precursor for a much larger quake in Alaska in March and April. We'd really have to go like point by point.
We've also got Etna coming alive. We've got a volcano that seems to be brewing off the Oregon coast right now.
Yeah, there's a huge one actually directly, you know, you're right, off the coast of Oregon, Washington, that's an oceanic quake. But in some ways, that's good because it's actually taken a lot of the pressure off of Mount Rainier and Mount Baker, the land-based quakes. It's bad in the fact that if that ruptures and blows, you're looking at tidal wave activity through Washington and Oregon. You know, the biggest trigger for this is going to be, once again, you know, I predicted the eruption of Montserrat, but Montserrat is just the beginning of a chain or a pattern that Montserrat blew approximately 14 months before Mount Pelée blew in 1902. So you're looking at the exact same pattern as happening again with Mount Pelée. So you're going to see the eruptions. You've already seen eruptions of Etna and Vesuvius, but in that chain, you're going to see Mount Pelée is going to go on the Isle of Martinique. You're going to see Etna and Vesuvius begin to erupt. You've had an entire series of earthquakes in Italy, which is going to bring about, you know, political, religious, along with geological changes as well.
Listen, we've got photographs on Etna. Hold on right where you are, Sean. We'll be back to you right after the break. I want to tell everybody once more, because of the volume of information in the program you're hearing right now and that will continue for yet another hour, if you want to get a copy, and I know gazillions of you do, we have a 24-hour number, and you can order a copy of this show and sort of pick it apart piece by piece. The number is 1-800-917-4278. Operators are lounging about now, waiting for your call. 1-800-917-4278. This is Coast to Coast AM. Why does he think there has been a NASA cancellation of all manned flights to the moon and Mars? Now, they may be backtracking on this a little bit, but the other day they, in fact, announced a virtual quarantine that we would not go to Mars, we would not go to the moon with men or anywhere else for that matter for a long time. Any thoughts on that, Sean?
Well, I mean, the first primary thought is that we've already got bases up there. That we've got probably 25 to 5,000 working personnel on at least the moon. I've seen photographs taken by Apollo 11 of gigantic shuttlecraft that were taken in 1969, and I've got eyewitness testimony of scientists who worked on very, very large shuttlecraft technology, you know, as of, I think the earliest one I found was 1967 or so. There just does seem to be a... There's three levels of technology. There's the civilian level of technology, which is all the junk that doesn't really work. There's the military level of technology, which is about 10 to 15 years ahead of anything that we've ever heard of. And there seems to be a shadow level of technology above that, that seems to be a technology where not a single technological advance made by man over the last 500 years or so has ever been allowed to be lost, and that there is a possibly a group of secret societies or a gang of very, very wealthy families that have been operating, consolidating their wealth and their power for not just dozens of years, but conceivably hundreds of years, that have actually developed a Star Trek 24th century level of technology that's being used. Now, I don't know anything about Mars because I've never actually seen any photographs or, you know, had any proof. It seems like every time we send stuff up to Mars, it either disappears or gets eaten or vanishes, and so there might quite conceivably be something or someone else up there. You know, but the problem is that they can't allow our technology to evolve. The whole trick of all the UFO stuff and Area 51 and everything else and why people should be upset about it is because at some point, probably in the 50s or 60s, the government figured out what gravity is, and that statement is not what gravity does, but what it is, and that they've learned how to generate gravity exactly like they would generate microwaves in an oven or x-rays in a machine. And once you understand what gravity is, the game's pretty much over. You can travel in time, travel in space virtually instantaneously, and then you develop incredible technologies that will basically wipe out the entire socio-political economic structure of the fossil fuel based system.
There you go. All right. Well, here's what's going on right now. We have a craft circling Mars right now. Aerobraked. It's circling Mars. It will soon begin to send back high resolution photographs of the face on Mars and the artifacts around the face on Mars.
I doubt it will happen.
Now we've got Van Flandren who is deeply involved in this project, saying, look, folks, get ready, because what's on Mars, the face, is not natural. It's going to change everything we know and believe. Prepare yourselves. That's pretty serious stuff, and I'm wondering if this spacecraft is going to suddenly run into a brick wall of some sort of...
or suddenly just disappear.
That's right.
You know, the Brookings Institute put out a report in 1962. It was a white paper that said to NASA that within 30 years that we would encounter extraterrestrial archaeology or extraterrestrials themselves, and at all costs that information must be covered up because they felt that it would... that it would destroy the personal, psychological, and religious systems of mankind. You know, we're at the end of the revolution of Copernicus. Copernicus taught us that we're not the center of the universe geographically, but we still believe that we're the center of the universe spiritually. And I think government has some sort of agenda to not dissuade us of that belief.
Exactly right. Couldn't agree more. Wild Card Line, you're on the air with Sean David Morton. Hello.
Hello.
Hi.
Hello.
Hi.
This is, I'm calling from, suburban Milwaukee, Wisconsin.
Oh boy.
WTMJ.
Right.
And I have a message for you, Art Bell.
Oh.
We think your program is so far above any other type of program. And I immediately got some very, very strange and troubling vibrations, and I am quite psychic. I get this through music, and I wondered if your guest got any such feelings when he heard of your brand new associates.
Ah, our new associates.
No, I just wanted Art to loan me some money.
No, my vibes are all good on this score. We're very, very proud to be part of J-Core and company.
I think it's just great that you're just getting the recognition that you deserve, and that you definitely are a jewel in the crown of whatever company is going to be associated with you, Art. And I'm just, I'm proud of you, and I just hope your audience just appreciates what an amazing and incredible service that you do. And you really are the best there is at what you do. And I'm not just stroking you because you're my pal. I'm just saying that, you're great at what you do, and I really appreciate you, and I'm glad everybody else does too.
Thank you, my friend. East of the Rockies, you're on the air with Sean David Morton. Hello. Hello, hello.
Good morning.
Good morning. Where are you?
Good morning, Art, Sean.
Good morning.
Joseph from Indiana, WLS Radio.
Yes, sir.
Great show, Art.
Thank you.
I'd like to get back to the computer crash, if I may.
Oh, you may.
If one does not want to accept cards or implanted chips after the computer crash, will paper money have any value?
I don't know. The only reason that I think that paper money will still have some value is that the cash is going to exist because you've got so much. You have so many people in very, very high positions still dealing with so much drug money that they have to be able to have that, that slush fund, if you will. But it's eventually going to come down to, the old saying about how people will throw gold and silver into the streets. And, it eventually comes down to what really is of value, Joseph, and that's basically what you know and who you know. It's going to be all about knowledge and family. And that's eventually what anything always comes down to.
Okay, I guess you answered the second part of my question. I was wondering if you had any suggestions on how to weather these times monetarily.
Yeah, that really is a good question, not just monetarily, but weather the times, period.
Okay, the biggest thing going on right now is that you're going to continue, I think, to see rises in the stock market. There's going to be a lot of money until October, I might add. When I think that there's going to be about the third week of October, there's going to be an implosion of the market. I still think you're going to see the market go to 10,000, possibly the ultimate ceiling is about 12,000 or so. But that's only if they manage to convert Social Security into some form of investment mutual fund. The best investment right now, bar none, and it's one of the things that I'm putting my cash into, is pre-1933 gold coins. And the best reason for that is because they're so incredibly low right now. What's the price of gold now, Art?
Oh, it bottomed at about 280. It's hovering around 300, I believe.
Yeah,
now.
It's going to be, and that's just because the stock market is so strong. The reason you want to get pre-1933 gold coins is because they're grandfathered and are not covered by the Federal Gold Confiscation Act.
That's right.
So if you get the $20 gold pieces, or if you get the silver gold pieces, right now they are so dead low as far as the price goes. It's going to be one of the best investments of the year, unless you know how to pick technology stocks, because there's going to be a lot of medical stocks that are going to be skyrocketing. Entertainment stocks are going to be going through the roof. This is going to be one of the best years ever for Hollywood.
It's already a good year.
But that's very short-term stuff. In the long term, where you're living at in Indiana, it's always good to have a hard currency on hand. Know a lot about how to grow food and how to build buildings and, learn how to do practical stuff with your hands.
Look, the golden rule is buy low, sell high, whether it's the market or gold.
Right. Yeah. So, in the long term, in the long run, as I said, it's going to be, and you're going to see this as early as the beginning of next year, people beginning to form spiritual communities that are not going to be based on, old-style monetary values. It's going to be an entirely new way of thinking and a brand-new way of dealing with life.
All right. West of the Rockies, you're on the air with Sean David Morton. Hello.
Hello.
Hi.
This is Tom calling from Kailua, Hawaii.
Hey, Tom.
Yes.
Hey, aloha.
Hey, how you doing?
Good, thanks.
I have a question for Art and two questions for Sean David Morton.
All right. Hit me with it.
Okay. Art, I was wondering if you ever got to read the mail or listen to the tapes about the Bible End Time Prophecy Perspective?
That you sent?
Yes.
I believe that I have them. Yes, I do have them.
But not to read or listen yet?
Not yet. No, they're in a stack, my friend, but we'll get to them.
Okay. And in regard to the construction of the pyramids, I sent something along about that said it's no mystery.
All right.
That according to the Bible book of Numbers chapter 2 verse 32, you can know that the Israelite slaves' labor was in the hundreds of thousands of manpower.
Well, yes, you would agree then with Azahi Awas, who says there is no mystery about how they were built, and he demonstrated that to me. Listen, do you have a question for Sean?
Yes. Also, one more thing about a prior show you had, Art, about the cloning and why Israel supports cloning.
Yes, cloning.
Yes, you know about the red heifer that
yes, I do,
recently
sir.
Came. Of course, they're very rare, and if you were going to resume temple worship, you would need a resource of them.
All right, time is very short, so let us move to a question for Sean, if you've got one.
Yes, the question for Sean is that according to Christ's prophecy to John in the book of Revelation, there are at least four future prophetic events that need to occur before the world comes to the Antichrist being in power over a one-world economic, political, and religious system. And these include the Gog-Magog War, which is a Russian-Islamic coalition,
right,
the rapture of the Christian believers, a peace agreement proposed by the Antichrist, and the rebuilding of the Jewish temple. Mm-hmm. And in light of all these events spanning approximately 4 to 7 years, it seems that your timing is off on that 1999 prediction, which, if you could go over that again.
Okay.
And then one
give
other
me the easy
question.
One thing at a time. Go ahead, Sean.
In a minute, eh? it doesn't have to be in that time frame. Like I said, I think what's going to happen is that there's no specific time frame given in Revelation. It's given in Daniel. You have to. There's a time and half a time of either. Some people say 3.5 years. Other people say 7 years. Those could also be prophetic days. Specifically, God, this is a very hard question to answer. I'm not trying to duck the question. It's just, it would take a really long time to answer this question. You've got the four horsemen of the apocalypse. The first horseman, there's debate as to whether or not that horseman is actually, the man on the white horse is actually the gospel, of God knowing this, or the gospel of the Christos. The second horseman being, the man who rides the black horse who has he's got a set of scales. That specifically leads to an antichrist that's a financial antichrist. That's a person who sets up a financial system. And specifically talks about the antichrist breathing life into the beast, which I think, and the number of the beast is 666, which relates to human DNA, which specifically would be a biocomputer of some kind, which is exactly what we've been talking about as far as the beast computers, the battle engagement area simulation and tracking computers,
right,
which are DNA computers. I think that they're actually living organisms. You know, the rest of your question is so hard to answer because I think we're entering a 40-year exodus period. I think from 1999 until the coming of the messianic figure that's predicted by the Great Pyramid, that doesn't happen until the year 2034. So we got a long, long, long way to go, and we might not even be in the millennial period. We might be in a 1,000-year period now, according to the time coding of the pyramid, that this next 1,000 years is a premillennial period, and that the true millennium doesn't actually come until 2989, which is when the Tibetans talk about the real Lord Maitreya, the true Maitreya, or the true Christ, actually comes and the capstone of the pyramid is returned and the four-squared city of Jerusalem actually comes down from the sky. That doesn't happen until close to the year 3000. So we got a long ways to go.
All right. He also broached the subject of cloning. We've got Dolly. We've got people switching monkey heads. We've got...
Right.
Oh, my gosh, we've got all kinds of things going on.
Well,
Dr. Seed wants to clone a human being in the next 90 days.
It's going to start happening. What I've seen in the future, and I've published this a couple of times in the newsletter, is that, you know, there's like an army of clones that, you know, that apparently people have to hunt down or track down. This is about 20 years in the future. The initial application for this is going to be in the cloning of human organs. And it's a technology I've already seen demonstrated by a man by the name of Dr. George Merkel in Texas, who's actually, you know, who can clone a kidney or clone a heart and use it as replacement. I think that's going to be the rational first application of cloning is to be for organ transplants.
All right. First time caller line, your turn with Sean David Morton. Hello.
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 Yes.
Yes, you're on the air, sir.
Oh, Yeah, I'm first time caller. And
hey.
I had a question for Sean.
All right, turn your radio off. That's number one. Get that radio off and tell us where you're calling from.
I'm calling from Texas City, Texas.
Okay.
All right, Texas.
Okay. I was wondering, earlier you were talking about aliens coming from the future, coming back here, and
I just said it was a theory, boss. I was just saying that from some contactees that they've claimed that that these are beings from something like 5,000 years in the future who are coming back to get genetic materials and water and food and all that. I'm just relating one story from a contactee.
So we don't have any idea where exactly they're coming from.
Well, according to this contactee, they were coming from Earth.
Oh, okay, I see.
They're from our future, and that they were coming back to get certain, you know, genetic materials because the Earth had become, you know, sort of dead 5,000 years from now.
Okay, I see. I had a second question also.
Sure.
I was wondering, do you think any of that has to do with what's going on with the quarantine that they've imposed on us here on Earth, this, you know, with NASA and all that stuff and what's going on with the...
Well, he really already answered that question.
Yeah.
The quarantine, if you want to think of it as a quarantine, and I guess you can, is because we really have all the technology that will allow us to move as we will anyway. We're on the moon already, you said?
Yes, and I think that's what Area 51 and Pine Gap and all these top secret bases are all about, that we're freely coming and going from the moon using this technology, and that there are bases on the backside, and, in, you know, there's Tycho Brahe, King Crater. You know, there's bases all over the moon and structures, and I think we've reactivated ancient structures that have been there for a long time.
You know, it's interesting. I got a call from John Lear the other day. John, who I've not heard from in so long.
Yeah, he's been, wow.
He's getting active again. And
oh,
you know,
that's great.
You know what he said? He said, Art, I talked to Bob Lazar, and I pointed all these things out on the moon that I'm seeing, that I've documented, and Lazar said, look, if there's stuff up there on the moon, the stuff you've got there, I'll kill myself. And he wrote that down on a piece of paper. Lazar did. And then he went and did research, and he found a whole bunch of stuff on the moon, came back to John, said, look what I've got. And, of course, John said, well, then you've got to kill yourself. And Lazar said, no, that's the stuff you found on the moon. This is the stuff I found on the moon.
There's so much stuff up there, it's not even funny. I'm just... I'm glad that John's active again because he's one of the great grand old men of this entire field, and everybody owes him a debt of
thanks. Hold tight. We'll be right back. Haley wants to know what the frequency of our new Detroit affiliate is going to be. Our new Detroit affiliate is going to be CKLW, CKLW in Windsor, and they cover, two-thirds of the U.S., something like that. That'll be coming up around the 8th of February, somewhere in there. A lot of big new affiliates coming on board. CKLW, one of those. So Detroit, get ready, because here we come in a big, big way. Again, if you want to order a copy of this program, you can call 24 hours a day. If you can get through, 1-800-917-4278. That's 1-800-917-4278. From UK News, the following. Listen to this, Sean. Smart cards with a personal identification code that will allow people to pay taxes, claim benefits, apply for a passport without filling out a form or speaking to an official are being now developed by the government. Scientists are working on technology that would provide each and every citizen with a unique security code for the plastic cards, which could be used in kiosks similar to telephone boxes. Though the code will initially be a PIN number, researchers are hoping to allow an individual to be identified by a fingerprint, an iris scan, or even a DNA sample. How about that?
Well, and in these same kiosks, if your iris scan or your DNA sample don't match your card, can they instantaneously vaporize you on the spot?
Well, they don't say that here, but...
Gee, I just wonder if that's the next step. Yeah, they're going to... I'd heard about the same thing. They're absolutely going to do it in England first. My stepdad always used to say, he said, you watch, if you want to see what's going to happen in the United States, just watch England, because they always do it to England first, and the United States is always 5 to 15 years behind what they're doing in England. And of course, they can force all this stuff on people in England because they're subjects of the crown, unlike us, who are supposedly free citizens here. It's a little bit different. We have inalienable rights guaranteed by the Constitution. The British don't have anything like that. If the Queen tells you to do something, you got to do something. So,
their press isn't even free. They can be censored.
Oh yeah, of course. And you know, they can be censored in Canada as well. And people don't realize that, you know, Canada and Australia both are, that there's only one citizen in the entire British, United Kingdom, and that's the Queen. Just one. Everybody else is a subject, as opposed to the sovereign citizens here in the United States. One other thing, too, I just had a friend of mine call me. I guess he just sort of whipped up a website for me here. So, just real quick for anybody that's interested, I guess it's now at www.drumquest.com/Sean, S-E-A-N, David, D-A-V-I-D.
Wait a minute. Start all over again. www.drumquest.
D-R-U-M, quest, Q-U-E-S-T.
Right.
.com/Sean David Morton. So a friend of mine just called me, and I guess he's one of those webmaster pros, and said, "Hey, I whipped something up for you." So, and it's got I guess it connects to different sites, and it's got some static stuff about the newsletter and all that.
All right, I'm sure that Keith is listening right now. www.drumquest.com/Sean David Morton.
Right.
All right.
So that was just something that was just whipped up real quickly for anybody that wants to check that out. And can I mention the newsletter one last time?
Of course, okay, the Delphi Associates newsletter.
The Delphi Associates newsletter, once again, it's published by PRI, the Prophecy Research Institute. It's $50 for 12 issues. It's well worth it. I work real hard on it. You can make checks payable to PRI and send them to 2207 Hermosa Avenue. That means beautiful in Spanish. Hermosa, H-E-R-M-O-S-A. And we're located in Hermosa Beach, California. And the zip code is 90254. Just to repeat the address one more time. It's $50. You can make checks or money orders payable to PRI, Prophecy Research Institute. And we are at 2207 Hermosa Avenue, H-E-R-M-O-S-A. And that's Hermosa Beach, California, 90254. And we also have a 24-hour hotline, which will repeat all that information. And that's at area code 310-310. And the phone number is 217-7579. That's 310-217-7579.
Excellent, my friend. Wild card line, you're on the air with Sean David Morton. Hello.
Hello. My question is, I'm from Salt Lake City.
Hi.
Hi, Sean. Hi, Art.
Hi. What's your name?
My name is Helen.
Hi, Helen.
My question is for how the elderly will more or less survive short term, say the next 5 years, if there aren't social security checks.
Well, actually,
you've got
a better chance of it in Salt Lake City, just because you know the Mormons believe in community and taking care of their own and the tithing structures and also the Mormons save more food. I think isn't the entire Mormon tabernacle filled with canned food and canned goods? You see, once again, when these societal structures begin to break down, it's going to be all about knowledge and family. That's why. People need to fix their family ties and start forming these communities. And of course, senior citizens are going to be valued immensely once again, simply because of their grace and wisdom and knowledge.
I agree with Sean. You're a lot better off there. Imagine being in L.A. and having Social Security stop.
Well, but wouldn't you be better off in a very small town, 60 or 70 miles from a big city?
Yes and no. I mean, it depends. I mean, it depends on whether or not you're growing your own food and you have access to a rural agricultural area or not. And I don't think it's all going to sort of collapse. It's all going to sort of fall apart rather slowly, I think. And the major cities like Los Angeles are going to be hit the worst because.
Sure.
Places like Los Angeles and Phoenix, I mean, we live in an artificial environment. The Mulholland Aqueduct is built right on top of the San Andreas Fault. And if there's a major earthquake that ruptures the Mulholland Aqueduct, we're done. I mean, you can imagine what Los Angeles is going to be like when you can't get water to the 12 million people that live here.
Have you considered moving?
I have, yeah. Not quite yet, but I mean, I believe I will by the end of next year.
All right. East of the Rockies, you're on the air with Sean David Morton, who's got the flu, the remnants of the flu. Hello there.
Sorry.
Hello, calling from Mercer, Pennsylvania. I heard Sean say something that I totally agree with, that even the Security Council members feel that Iraq has complied as much as they possibly can with these sanctions, which, by the way, are 100 times more onerous and vicious than anything imposed on Germany after the First World War, and everybody says that was too much. But I believe that if we have not lost our soul in what Sean was talking about, the use by the United States once again of weapons of mass destruction, including tactical nuclear weapons, after dropping the equivalent of 6 atomic bombs on that country, killing 250,000 people, and since that time, even according to the United Nations, starving, causing the death of hundreds of thousands of children in that country, I think we've lost our soul. The true obscenity, the true sleaze, has nothing to do with Clinton. I think it's the cavalier way in which we discuss this, and the hypocrisy of supporting weapons of mass destruction, where we have 1,000 times more. Egypt and Saudi Arabia have chemical and biological weapons. The same with Israel, including nuclear weapons. We encourage other countries to invade other countries, like Indonesia invading East Timor and wiping out a third of the population with U.S. weaponry. When we see this kind of double standard and hypocrisy, how can we not speak up against this kind of propaganda that we're getting throughout the media that prepares us to use our weapons of mass destruction against that poor, tortured country? How would we like having these missiles coming crashing into Pahrump, Nevada, or Chicago, Times Square, Washington, being terrorized constantly, our country starved and constantly tortured by these sanctions?
Hang on a second. I agree completely, and it's ridiculous and absurd, and it just shows you, I think, how much the press controls what's going on with opinion here. And actually, the reason that was given by the Iraqi ambassador as to why they weren't allowing U.S. CIA weapons inspectors into the presidential palaces is because the United States has stated rather overtly through Madeleine Albright that they want to assassinate Saddam Hussein. Why would you let somebody that wanted to kill you, into your house? Which was the reasons why the U.S. inspectors were turned away, but it's also the reason why the United States is going its way alone in this conflict, because we can't get anybody to agree with the onerous treatment of the Iraqis when they've done everything that we've asked them to do. They've groveled as low as they can go.
So yeah, I'm told now that Madeleine Albright is off not consulting with in terms of trying to get help from our allies, but simply telling them what we are about to do.
Right, yeah. Well, you know, her saying that there's going to be a peaceful solution is just nonsense, and it's just, you know, once the fourth warship gets there from England, you know, we'll launch the attack, and it doesn't matter what they say. And, you know, and does it have to do with oil prices dropping in the United States? Does it have to do with the fact that we are scared to death that we let Iraqi oil back on the world market again? You know, I don't believe that Iraq is now or has ever been a threat to the United States outside of, you know, outside of simply threatening, you know, the balance of power as far as oil goes, because if we let Iraq back on the world market, then the price of gas will drop to, you know, 90, 80 cents or something like that, you know, some ridiculously low rate.
Mm-hmm. West of the Rockies, you're on the air with Sean David Martin. Good morning.
Good morning, Art. This is Jerry in Reno listening to KOH.
Yes, sir.
Hey, I love Reno. I got a place in Tahoe.
It's a beautiful place to live.
Indeed.
Sean, did I understand you correctly earlier to say that we do not have or know about any antibiotics that are currently effective against the flu epidemic?
According to the doctor that I went to, I asked him, you know, they gave me personally antibiotics that didn't work at all. This particular flu. He said that there were no,
Look, antibiotics don't work against flu, period.
They work against
the secondary, infections you might get from the flu, like pneumonia or something like that.
Yeah.
That was the point I wanted to make, Art, because to me that's kind of stating a fact in such a way as to create a wrong impression.
Well, when I went to the doctor, I didn't have any signs of pneumonia. Nevertheless, I got prescribed antibiotics.
Yeah, that's the prophylactic use of antibiotics.
That's
which is one of the things they've talked about that has caused a lot of the drug-resistant organisms.
That's right.
But we've never had any antibiotics that work against any flu virus.
Well, the doctor said you get a flu shot. He also told me about how they go down to Australia and they take samples of the flu for preventative measures to then come up and, you know, I'm sorry if I left that impression. He said they missed this particular flu as far as actually being able to get the strains of the flu to be able to inject people with flu shots here. And, yes, I got antibiotics, and the antibiotics didn't work at all. So.
Right, but they don't work against the flu. They stop the secondary infections.
You're absolutely right. I'm sorry I left that impression.
Yeah, he's right. They give it for prophylactic reasons, preventative reasons. In other words, they assume that you may be on your way to pneumonia, and they want to stop that cold.
Right.
And so I understand that. I mean, a doctor does what he thinks is best for his individual patient, but that leads to an awful lot of dispensing of an awful lot of antibiotics that eventually results in the overcoming of antibiotics by all of these little things that are going to get us.
Mm-hmm.
First-time caller line, you're on the air with Sean David Morton. Hi.
Hello, Art and Sean. This is Mel from Southern Illinois.
Yes, sir.
Hi, Mel. And Art, if I could, I wanted to make a quick statement about one of the abductees that you had call in last night.
All right.
I did a reversal on that, and you would not believe how many reversal statements I got out of that. You should have some of that reversed for yourself.
Depend on it.
Okay. Also, Sean, I wanted to ask about, it seemed like a lot of the sightings and abductions that I've seen from my own experience, not that I have been abducted or had any sightings myself, but it seems like a lot of them are coming from near large bodies of water, and I wondered if you had any statements on that. And the shape of the ships, you said, were in the shape of Alpha and Omega.
Yes.
And I wondered if...
Those are the ones over Phoenix.
I wondered if that had any biblical coincidence.
I think they do. I mean, you know... Geez, when you have these gigantic craft that look like giant A's or boomerangs and ships that look like, you know, sort of rounded ovals with two big fins off either side, I mean, you know, what else could it be? You know, that's one of the reasons why I mentioned it, that these craft are rather ominously shaped like alphas and omegas. The other thing is that you're right, there's a huge amount of UFO sightings underwater and above water.
Around
water, that, you know, they, two-thirds of the Earth's surface is water, so, you know, what better place for them to hide or have bases? Another aspect of this is that there's been numerous reports of these craft specifically large cigar-shaped, metallic-looking silver tubular craft.
That's right.
Actually over freshwater bodies taking on water. In other words, actually just sucking water up into the craft, you know, hundreds and hundreds of metric tons of water up into the ships. The only explanation I was given from this, again, from a contactee, is that these were, and this was just the story that I was told, that these were supposedly people from many thousands of years in the future that are looking for, you know, supplies here from Earth. That's the only thing I can, you know, that's the only explanation that I've gotten from anybody that claims to have any contact.
Sean, is the weight of your predictive ability something that that hangs on you heavily? In other words, do you feel a great responsibility knowing these things?
Yes, and one of the reasons why I started the newsletter was to try to get the information out there. Of course, obviously, you're hanging it out over the line, you know, every month when you're trying to do this. And the reason I started the newsletter was because when I came back from the monastery in Nepal, and the first major earthquake event that I predicted was this gigantic earthquake in the Loma Prieta earthquake in San Francisco in 1989.
Right.
And I went to Mount Shasta on the 1st of October with a group of about, 25, 30 people to try to do prayers and try to do meditations and try to, absorb and deflect the energy. And then to have the quake happen 17 days later and not have any way to warn anybody, not have anybody way to tell, other than, taking off my clothes and, getting a stick and putting ash on my head and walking through downtown San Francisco. not through the Castro district.
Can we deflect these events? Is there any way to do that, or are these things really predestined? Does there come a point where they're going to happen no matter what?
In some instances, the only thing I can say is that the planet itself is very much like a college. It's this is not a sacred world. It's a university. It's a school planet, and so people come here to learn very, very specific things. Now, the question is, do you study hard when you first get here when you're a freshman and you get all your requirements out of the way, or do you put them all off until you're just about to graduate and then have to pull the all-nighters and, do all the suffering in order to finally get out of the school? So the quantum of the future, I don't think can be changed, because the aspect of it has a lot to do with it being a group reality. You literally have some 6 billion people on the planet who are all creating the universe as we know it as sort of a gigantic hologram. And I found a way to not only tap into the consciousness of the planet, but also to tap into that mass consciousness to see very specific events before they occur. And, of course, the greatest aspect of this is that if I did not believe that prophecy and prediction cannot be changed by intelligent action, I wouldn't be doing this at all. I mean, there would be really no point in it.
So at some point, the future is malleable, but by the time you generally see it and make a prediction, it's a done deal.
Yes. I wouldn't say that is set in stone. I would say that we have already managed to change time substantially from 1993 on, from 1989 on. I mean, there was a reality in which we had a very real aspect of the Edgar Cayce predictions of the entire West Coast falling into the ocean. That is no longer happening anymore, and I believe it's happening because humanity has woken up in spirit. We've woken up in our hearts. We've woken up more and more to our relationships with God and the Creator and each other. And I think that the greatest thing is that mankind's destiny is back in his own hands, but that's
Sean,
also the bad news as well.
That's it, my friend. We're out of time.
Thank you. Another incredible
program, maybe the best we've ever done. Thank you,
Art.
And good night.
Good night, America.